We had a tragic event in our community recently. The very popular owner of Camouflage, Shannon Collins, was killed, as I'm sure you're all aware, by a homeless transient who had recently come into town from San Francisco with a long history of violence, who had apparently significant mental illness issues. And for whatever reason, and so far as I can tell, like, there's been no motivation or anything else. Out of the blue, he stabbed the lady who was 38 years old, was only 2 years younger than me, to death in broad daylight. And she walked back from a hair salon on Broadway. And that was obviously very upsetting. Lots of people have been talking about it. As the husband of someone who owns a small business in Santa Cruz, obviously, it hit me a little bit directly, personally, because, of course, that could have been my wife. And so, of course, unlike the numerous other murders that occur over the course of a year, this has become one of those significant events in the life of the community, and has provoked a vast amount of discussion about the predictable topics based on the fact that the alleged and pretty clearly actual perpetrator of this particular crime happened to be housed at the homeless service center in the loft. At least that's what I have heard for several days prior to that. And, you know, as has happened several times in the relatively recent past, this produced a massive outcry that something must be done. And, of course, the city council, in response to this outcry, has decided to do something. And, you know, I looked over the whole list of what it is proposing to do, at least the stuff that I saw in the Santa Cruz Sentinel article on, what's the date? 5/16. Yeah, so by J.M. Brown. And so, of course, the city council is dancing around the Brown Act here, since they hadn't had a chance to have a meeting. So only three of the seven could actually coordinate anything. And the other four just have to look on and, I guess, applaud and provide their input via public commentary to the press. And, you know, all I have to say about this, there's a lot to say about this. And, of course, the gentleman whose show follows me is probably going to have a lot more to say about this. And he may even call in with a guest to my show. Well, if I could sum it up in one word, I'd say horseshit. You know, really, I have to say that if the city council was thought that the various proposals that they're making would actually have a tangible and marked effect on the quality of life in this community, that they certainly would have made them before someone got killed. And now they're making them after someone got killed. And, you know, really, I want to see someone, anyone, argue that any of these proposals could have even conceivably done anything to prevent the precipitating event, the brutal public murder of a woman, from happening. And, you know, I'm not seeing it. They want to require that everybody who uses the homeless service center they want to ignite an overall cultural shift in how the city deals with homelessness. And, you know, that's the Sentinel's take, and that's just like, give me a break. You know, what it all comes down to is Santa Cruz is at the end of a highway. It's on a beach. The weather here is really good. If you're going to live outdoors, are you going to live in Fargo, North Dakota? Are you going to live in Seattle, Washington? Are you going to live in Texas? Are you going to live in Santa Cruz? And the answer is, you're going to live in Santa Cruz. And if you become homeless in Santa Cruz, where are you going to live? Most likely in Santa Cruz. The fact is, the vast majority of the homeless people in the city and county are locals. And, you know, that's not to say there's not a significant number of people who come here and spend some time being homeless or marginally housed. And there's probably a lot more people who come here and are marginally housed than are homeless. Some of them leave. Quite a number of them leave. Because it's very hard to actually get yourself off the street and into shelter in Santa Cruz County, even with the aid of social services, which are relatively limited. You know, the city's $184,000 a year that funds the Homeless Service Center is not, you know, anything earth-shattering. Fundamentally, what it comes down to is you could remove every single homeless service from this city, and the likelihood is that it would not significantly impact the population of mentally ill, homeless, out-of-town individuals wandering around downtown Santa Cruz. Because the fundamental driving factors are the overall economy, the overall funding for social services from the federal government and the state, etc. That's what drives homelessness in general. But the overall factors that cause people to be here are the weather and the fact that the downtown is a highly concentrated mix of a good target audience for someone that's looking to panhandle. I mean, bluntly, that's the case. Tourists, students, those are two big target audiences. Plus, there's the river, the levee, there's lots of wooded, bushy areas all around town where you can go camp out, etc. How do I put it? People have this, and the city wants to ban any more new homeless service facilities from the city. And, you know, my comment about that is, A, these people weren't likely to be excited or support new homeless services in the city limits, especially any that were funded or partially funded by the city. That just wasn't going to happen anyway. And two, they have it all backwards. The reason the services are here is because this is where the homeless people come. The homeless people don't come here because of the services. The services come here because of the homeless people. They follow the homeless people. And if anybody thinks that, like, getting rid of these services and that's taking all these people out of the system, preventing them from getting access to social services, mental health counseling, physical health services, housing, all the other things that are likely to ameliorate the worst aspects of their existence and possibly get them on the road to recovery or stability, etc. You know, you're not being rational. The fact is that even a criminal with a long, violent history that's mentally ill, unless he has specific or she has specific legal enforced restrictions on where they can go for probation or parole or court orders or anything else, those people can pretty much live. Someone who's murdered 7 people and has gotten out of jail, however that happens, or who's, like, you know, has a string of like 20 assaults and hasn't wound up in jail permanently because of the 3 strikes law, they can move and live pretty much anywhere. And even if they can't live somewhere, there's nothing preventing them from going somewhere. And in fact, there's pretty much nothing preventing them from being homeless anywhere. And that's the blunt truth. And so where are they going to go? They're going to go to the end of the bus line. They're going to go to the beach. They're going to go to where the weather is good and to where the people are more likely to be generous than not, and where they perceive there's some chance that they can be physically safe, which is out of sight, in the bushes, etc. That's just the facts. It's the nature of Santa Cruz that we are going to attract homeless people. And the reason the social services are here is not because our city is somehow more exaggeratedly generous or our police are somehow more excessively tolerant. At all. Because realistically, we are not particularly generous from a taxpayer perspective, and we are not particularly excessively tolerant from a legal perspective. What we do have is county buildings that have been here for decades. And again, here's the city leaders. They're ranting on about the fact that we have the jail downtown. They're ranting on about Emmeline. And they're saying that we're already overburdened. We can't have any more homeless services here. And the fact is, the jail is not a homeless services thing. It happens to let people out of jail. Thank you, folks. Thank you for calling. I forgot to turn the mic up. So, all right. Thank you. All right. So, yeah, I forgot to turn the mic up. A little bit of a thing there. What can I say? So, you know, we had a recent tragedy. Shannon Collins was killed. And as is the usual pattern, our city leaders have reacted after the event. You know, this has happened repeatedly. And so they come up with a list of proposals. And, you know, they go backwards addressing the Santa Cruz Sentinel article. They've been complaining about the fact that the jail is downtown and that the sheriff and the county just released the inmates straight out of the jail into downtown for years and years and years. And the sheriff has had the same response. We don't have the resources. We don't have the infrastructure. It's not our responsibility to transport people somewhere else. And we can't legally compel people to go somewhere else. And it isn't really necessarily the county of Santa Cruz's responsibility, the taxpayers of Santa Cruz County's responsibility, to give people a free ride to anywhere in the country. And again, they can't be forced to take it. The jail is not going to move. And certainly the sheriff, not without a lot of money, is not going to change his position. And this has been multiple sheriffs with the same position. So that's off the table. So why is the city saying this? Well, it's because the city leaders have been saying this for years and they want to appear to be doing something. Emmeline is downtown. Emmeline is a county facility. Emmeline has been there for years and years and years. It happens to serve homeless people along with a hell of a lot of other people. And it's not going anywhere. And it's not going to go anywhere. Because I can't seriously believe that the city leadership really wants the county to spend a fortune to relocate all those services somewhere else in the middle of a massive budget crisis. And, you know, realistically, it's not even clear that there's any other place in the county which would be appropriate or even logistically feasible for it to be relocated to. So, again, why mention it? Except to, like, you know, appear to be doing something without actually doing something. Why mention the jail? Because the jail serves, quote unquote, a lot more people than just homeless people. So, you know, the city says, the leaders are saying, we aren't going to support the establishment of any more homeless service facilities in the city. And it's like, you were going to do this before? I didn't see any initiatives from your part to create more homeless services facilities in Santa Cruz County. I mean, in Santa Cruz city limits. In fact, I'm pretty sure that you would have, like, been opposed to that had anybody come up with that proposal. On the other hand, I have to say, and the city certainly wasn't going to come up with any money for that. On the other hand, I have to say that if, say, someone decided, like Reed Hastings or Philippe Cannes, two local multi-millionaires, to, say, donate, $10, $20 million to the Salvation Army to establish some kind of homeless services facility, I have a really hard time believing that all these people would get in the way of that, especially if no taxpayer money was involved. And again, suppose somebody donates, $10 million to Janus so that they can increase the number of beds that they have available to serve drug and alcohol-dependent individuals. I think right now there's like 10 beds or something. Is the city going to get in the way of that? If somebody offers, emergency domestic violence shelter program, $10 million to establish some kind of housing center for homeless women victims of domestic violence. Are the city leaders really going to stand up and say, we can't tolerate this? We're already overburdened. Give me a fucking break. I mean, seriously. So, this is more empty pandering. In fact, this entire article and all these proposals are nothing but empty pandering. They're like after-the-fact reactive political point-making bullshit. Because you can't tell me, no way that you can tell me that any of these, as many people pointed out, but the city leader somehow doesn't really want to acknowledge because, the truth, they have to say the truth that they can't actually do anything about this. None of these proposals would have had any reasonable, arguable basis for preventing this from happening. Because you can't stop people from coming here. You can't stop people from hitchhiking here. You can't stop people from taking the bus here. You can't stop people from driving here and enjoying the weather and panhandling downtown. You just can't. And, the fact that this guy happened to be in services at the homeless service center was a pure coincidence. If the homeless service center wasn't there, or if he had been in those programs, he probably still would have been here. Because, see, that's one of the things that the city leaders aren't willing to acknowledge, and neither are all these other people that, like, talk about Santa Cruz setting out a welcome mat or something. The fact is that the reason the services are here is because this is where the homeless people are. The services follow the homeless people. It's not the other way around. They go where the people they serve are. If all the people were in Watsonville, then all the services would be in Watsonville. That is just a blunt truth. And the fact that the city provides some tiny, relatively speaking, amount of money to support the homeless services center, $184,000 a year, that's like two staff positions plus office supplies. If that money went away, the homeless services center wouldn't go away. And if the homeless services center went away, all that you would get is you would have more homeless people without access to services, without the resources necessary to not be homeless, to deal with whatever mental issues or drug issues or personal issues or economic catastrophes that have put them on the street. I mean, that's just the blunt truth again. And what do you think the result of that would be? More whacked out, stressed out, desperate people on the street. They want to talk about rules saying, it has to focus on servicing local people. Well, you know, what's that going to do? All that's going to do is going to mean that people like this guy, the other people like this guy, are going to be that much more likely to have issues. Hello, caller. Okay. Hold on. I'm going to put you on the air. Hello?
Hi there. Hello?
Hello.
Hello. So, hi, Thomas, and I want to thank you for talking about this issue. This is Robert Norris calling.
Yes.
For those who don't know my fine tones, I usually do a show right after yours. Looks like I'm not coming in because I'm kind of recovering from hospital days. And, you know, I just want to thank you for... I both want to thank you and then realize that I may have kind of steered you in the wrong direction with this whole discussion, because this whole frenzy is, I think, as you point out, a diversion from real issues. You know, that's the concern. And I think our objective, you and I, and hopefully everybody really at some level, is to turn back to real issues and not to let this kind of hustle and scuffle and bustle and paranoia and...
It's reactive politics. It's the way the city manages its business.
Yeah.
When something happens, you get a whole bunch of politicians getting up there, making grand sounding proposals and making noise and stuff.
Yeah, I think that's what it is.
They won't do anything.
Also, it's kind of akin to the national scene where you have police state solutions being the answer to things, when in fact, I think they create less security and more fear and more crime. Although, you know, I suppose I don't have any stats to show that. There are some who say, you know, if you cut off people's hands, it'll stop them from stealing, and that may well be true. You know, they say that it was a very peaceful time under the Mongols when they controlled Asia, and they had, you know, mountains of skulls when they invaded town. So, you know, there's a cost to that kind of solution to things. I think it's one that all of us, even those who are rabidly anti-homeless and blame them for everything under the sun and want to see them removed from the streets, don't want to see in Santa Cruz anyway.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's fundamental, at least at this point, more or less, there's a certain fundamental limit on what you can do as a city official, as law enforcement or anything else, to prevent people from coming here and doing things. I mean, the fact is you can't. Even an individual like this, who, you know, apparently had a long history of violence and had serious mental illness issues, you know, there was nothing legally preventing him from coming to Santa Cruz.
Yeah, you know, I don't even want to raise that issue particularly, because I think it's a diversion. You know, I think if they really want to, as I said, people could institute police state measures. That's what some people are calling for, and they're calling for it at a national level using these bugaboos of drug war and terrorism. And I mean, a lot of people.
Well, yeah, people can call for that, but the rest of us have to realize that, you know...
Well, sure they are.
That we're the target.
They're calling for police surveillance. They're calling for checks. They're calling for the kind of crackdown that would allow the community to take a far more hostile view to people who are innocent but simply have no options but to be outside. They're calling for a crackdown on counterculture people who are more outside because they're outside the economy. They're not calling for it specifically, but that's really what they're saying, and that's the implications of what they're saying.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the problem. So I want to, you know, turn instead, if I can,
mm-hmm.
because I don't really have too much new to add to the debate. I mean, I don't have any police stats that the murder rate has gone up or down or in the middle, and I haven't seen any of that in the paper, which is interesting. I mean, I haven't seen the police department saying, hey, our murder rate is dropping, or, yeah, our murder rate is raising. We need a lot more police funding.
Well, I saw that Zach Friend, this police spokesperson in the Mid-County Post, basically said, you know, it's kind of hard to think of anything we could have done to prevent this.
Again, I'm not talking about that. You're getting lost in their debate. I don't want to get lost in their debate. I'm saying that there are no new stats I can add to the situation that would be, you know, that would prove something one way or the other. I mean, I'd like to be fair about it. I'd like to, you know, if I had Annalisa Cube, the head of Take Back Santa Cruz, in the studio as a guest, I would like to honestly assess her concerns and any objective evidence she brings in. But I don't have any objective evidence, and I would think that the police would have presented something of that kind, and frankly, their opinions don't impress me much in either direction. You know, I'm skeptical about it when they talk about the parking lot panic law and say that, you know, we need to have something about people lurking in the parking lots, but then they have no stats, and I'd be skeptical about it the other way. If they said, oh, everything's hunky-dory, if they want to conceal the fact that there is a rise in the crime rate. So I think we have to be fair to people who are concerned about a rise in the crime rate, if there is. But I don't see any stats on that. I don't see any evidence one way or the other.
But see, here the issue is, this isn't driven by stats. This whole thing is not driven by stats.
It's driven by perception.
By panic when individuals don't have stats,
and therefore I can't. There's no point in talking about it, other than fueling their frenzy. I don't want to fuel any more frenzy. You know what I want to talk about are real things that are happening, and I kind of want to shift the conversation a bit. Unless you have more to add, I'd be happy to listen to more thoughts you might have on this before I attempt to do that.
Well, I guess you know, again, you know what. You know, my concern is diffusing or otherwise just making it absolutely clear that, you know, the city leadership's responses here aren't substantive, and that they're politically driven, and they're pandering, and this is not an appropriate way to address any issues.
Yeah, you've said that, though, and, you know, I think it's been said, and, you know, I don't care about the city leadership's response, although I do. I mean, I want to characterize it as you do, but I think I'm about the ordinary citizen's response.
Right. So the ordinary citizen's response.
Keep talking. I've got to keep talking. I've got to get on to a call. I'll get right back to you. Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah. So I mean, so you know, taking the city leadership out of this, and you know, the immediate emotional reaction around everything else, et cetera, and going back to, you know, what are the underlying fundamental drivers? What are the underlying issues? You know, everyone's economically insecure. The economy has sucked for a while. This, you know, inevitably produces, you know, a somewhat of a increase in the amount of people who are homeless. Although, actually, the statistics I have seen say about 2,700 people in the county are homeless, which I find a little bit interesting because that's hovering around the same number that I've seen for the last decade. So I'm not sure how accurate those statistics are. I do personally have state that I see more people standing on medians and curbs and corners, you know, with signs asking for money or asking for food or asking for work, you know, at this point than I did a few years back.
You know, what we're in the middle of is, of course, a bankster-driven crackdown or meltdown of the economy.
Yes.
Mixed with foreign wars that are essentially
draining the budget
and looting the country.
Yes.
And, you know, creating more enemies abroad and more enemies who are legitimately trying to throw people out of, you know, foreign troops out of their country.
Well, it's also creating more terrorists at home.
Yeah, and it's creating, it's obviously, I mean, you know, and that Congress has no clue, as we know from its vote on Friday.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it wants to fund Afghanistan. It wants to fund indefinite detention and overturn the very good decision last week of a bold judge who said the whole provision of the National Defense Appropriation Act that says you shall be able to hold somebody without charges, without trial, without limit, is simply unconstitutional and lacks the scienter element, which means people don't even know what it is they can't do in order to avoid that kind of draconian punishment. So we have a, you know, we have a leadership all over the place that doesn't know shit. But I'm not talking to the leadership. As far as I'm concerned, the leadership is impossible, and that is why.
So you're talking to the people.
Right, on the street. Well, that's why when you inveigh about the leaders, and I will too, of course. You know, it's only pointful to do that at some to some extent. What I really want to talk about, and maybe it's good for others to talk about, is the issues. What the issues are, because the issues are really what affect us. The leaders can be tossed aside, but the issues cannot.
Yeah. What are known, proven, effective solutions that address the underlying, you know, issues? And actually make people feel more secure, because I think the average person, you know,
I'm not going to go into that. I mean, I don't have any expertise in what makes people feel more secure. You know, that's the problem with this whole discussion. We don't. I mean, at least I wouldn't venture into that realm. And I would suggest maybe you do. I don't know. You maybe have some special expertise.
So I think, you know, and this is based on, you know, my read is.
You continue to want to talk about this, though, as though the security is a big issue. We don't know if security is an issue. There has been no analysis as to whether we're any more or any less secure than we were a year ago or two years ago or 3 years ago. So as far as I'm concerned, I don't even want to go any further on that line, but you do. So go ahead.
Well, okay. So looking at this purely from a pragmatic perspective, politicians react to what they perceive to be the driving issues in the community, and those come from the flood of complaints and issues and letters and everything else that come into the publications and come into their offices and that they have in their personal discussions. And politicians would not be doing everything they're doing if they didn't think that there was a political benefit from appearing to take security-increasing measures.
You're going on about the politicians again, Thomas. I don't really give a shit about the politicians.
Well, the politicians are doing their stuff because average people are telling them stuff.
Right, so I don't really care. I'm interested in the issues. Can we get back to the issues?
All right, so to getting back to the issues is, again, what the most effective solutions to homelessness, the actual single most effective solution to homelessness is actually getting people housed, strangely enough.
Yeah.
And so,
again, my concern is not proposing stuff around that, which I think is obviously that and jobs are the issues, and a radical reformation of the economy that ends this creation of homelessness, which is what's happening.
Right, but you know what's tangibly can be done at a local level.
Well, that's something interesting that I hope you will discuss with people like Linda and Becky, who are more effective and spokespeople on that issue, and other activists who are. I don't really think people can do too much here, because I think the problems are, I mean, what I want to see is people's rights protected and people banding together to defend themselves, because they are going to be outside. And because they are outside, they have to take care of themselves, and they have to take care of each other, and we all have to take care of each other. The best way to do that is not to turn one group into a set of alien monsters who are, in fact, eyes on the street more likely rather than, a menace on the street. I mean, you know, there's so that's why I'm turning now. I'm really having trouble doing this, Thomas, because you're insisting on bringing it back. And I know I raised this issue initially because I wanted to, you know, to talk about the hysteria, and it's my fault. But I mean, I'm not going to be able to do my show today, and because I can't, and because you're going off to something probably around 9:30 or 9:45. Is that your plan?
Yeah, something like that, yes.
I'd like to be able to put in a few comments about some other issues that are real issues as far as I'm concerned, that, of course, are being pushed completely away by this mass hysteria. And, you know, that's. And I don't think we should do anything more about that one and kind of let it go, unless people have new substantive suggestions, which I think would be great. So now having said that, I actually got a couple of letters. Well, I've been getting complaints from the Homeless Lack of Services Center clients that they're being disabled people are being thrown off the lot. And I've also been getting complaints that there are, and this is some months back, no loitering zones being established around the area. So the Homeless Lack of Services Center is replicating in miniature the kind of anti-homeless attitudes which are in Santa Cruz. And it's interesting among some groups, and it's interesting that this predates all this, murder stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Predates it, so it has nothing really to do with the murder stuff. The murder stuff is a
right.
nice, you know, platform to climb on top of, and it's a way of, you know, screaming and ranting and raving about a platform that has already been accepted and implemented by the city by its persistent crackdown on homeless people that has been continuing and intensifying over the last decade and a half, at least, in terms of laws that make actually surviving outside more and more problematic. And, of course, you might say, well, you know, our police department's only arresting or only ticketing 30 or 60 people a month for sleeping ban violations, which, for those who don't know, it's illegal in Santa Cruz to sleep after 11 o'clock at night outside, even though there's shelter for less than 5% of the 1,500 to 2,000. It's an even smaller number now that the armory is closed. So there's a lot of people who are outside. And the idea, of course, traditionally that one group of people have is to drive people away from the area with anti-homeless laws. And that's the idea in many communities. And therefore, this, of course, creates pariah groups. And it's obviously socially dysfunctional and has nothing to do with the real behavior of the people other than that they are poor and that they are outside and don't have facilities. And I suppose, you know, can you then claim, that they don't have any social productivity on the one hand or human rights on the other? I've always felt no, that's not the case.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, is that hard? Can you prove that? Or is it a matter of faith? I don't know. But I know it's something that I've
it's a philosophical position. Because, I mean, yeah. I mean, you can't prove that someone has no social utility or something like that. You either think that that's the case or you don't. You either think someone should have rights or you don't. There's no proof one way or the other.
Well, I mean, I suppose, you know, you could do some empirical studies. And I mean, I just have anecdotal sense that people who are at one time in their lives outside at other times become very productive and then revered as citizens. Whether the revered is worthwhile, you know, any more so than the other is a matter to some extent of judgment. But insofar as we revere people later and then say, oh, at one time in their lives or various times in their lives they were homeless, that's, you know, a consideration. On the other hand, mm-hmm. you might say, well, you find some guy who's constantly hitting you up for change and, you know, he's lying around on the street all the time. Although you don't find many people like that in Santa Cruz, in spite of this upsurge of letters, I don't know that there's a lot of that happening. I think some people don't want to see any of that happening, and they are very sensitive to one incident of that happening to them.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also, of course, this friction level that happens, you know, when people when they sense this growing hostility to them as human beings, even though they previously lived a middle-class lifestyle, suddenly, you know, their health insurance kicked them out of their housing because they couldn't pay their health insurance, they couldn't pay their housing. Maybe they never had health insurance and they got sick. You know, the usual stuff. And then suddenly they're on the streets and they're being treated like shit and they shout back, oh, no, then they're abusive and they're being harassed every hour and a half by the police department. This becomes a kind of self-perpetuating war, class war that develops. And, you know, it itself creates the problems that supposedly are the complaints.
Well, yeah,
of the Take Back Santa Cruz type people of the downtown neighbors and the Santa Cruz neighbors type folks. And those are two organizations that are, you know, I guess the Santa Cruz Neighbors meets every couple of weeks in the community room of the police station, and they're sort of, you know, trying to get the police to crack down. And
the biggest aggravating factor of any issues that a homeless person has in terms of health, mental health, any of these other things, is being homeless. That is the most aggravating factor for any issues, even to the point of simply just being homeless makes it much more likely that you're going to continue to be homeless, even if there's nothing else going on.
And what's your evidence for that?
There's been studies done, and it's just basic common sense.
Yeah.
Being homeless is stressful. Stress is bad for you.
Right, you're making some broader claims about that.
Many people, if you look at the mortality rate, say, for people between the ages of 40 and 60, for people who are housed versus people who are not housed, it's a lot higher.
Yeah, you know, the problem, of course, is...
And so there's some empirical evidence saying that being homeless is unhealthy.
Well, the claim
is shortens your life.
The claim by those who are often my adversaries on this issue are that people get homeless because of bad choices, or maybe they don't, and they get homeless because of bad luck. And then, you know, they develop problems. Or that people have drug abuse problems themselves through their bad choices, or their bad associations, and that creates the homelessness, and it is the drug problem or the mental illness problem or the bad character problem that produces the real problem. That's the real issue, not the homelessness, which is a function of that. And that's the alternate argument, that at some point, if you ever want to really address it at a fundamental level, you have to address.
There are plenty of people with all these constellation of issues who are housed, you know, and somewhat functional.
That's true, and that would go against the idea that these things always produce homelessness. But I guess it can be said that if these things do produce homelessness, they are more important. The bad character, the bad drug use, the bad associations.
The homelessness aggravates, the state of being homeless aggravates all these things. If they weren't homeless, if they got into housing, then many of these issues would either be reduced or go away on their own, or they would be in a position where someone could actually focus on dealing with them, you know, if they had, you know, any incentive to do so. And the fact is, most homeless people, not all of them, but most homeless people don't want to be homeless.
So, but the point is that you know, that could, a person who is a critic of yours would look at that and say, no, not necessarily. A person who gets into a house like a criminal might be able to use the house with more facility. If he is a drug abuser, he could use, you know, he could be more effective and more intensive in his drug abuse.
Right, but there's actual evidence, studies.
Yeah, well, that's what I was asking you. I don't know where these studies are or what they are. So at some point, you know, pass them on to me, and I'll talk about them on my show.
Yeah, I will do that. But, you know, so the point there is, you know, there's if you want to have an evidence-based argument, then, you know, there's plenty of evidence, you know, supportive of a certain position. But Robert, that, like, none of this has anything to do with evidence. It has to do with emotions.
I know, but I'm trying to treat people and to treat those the comments that people make wherever they're coming from and deal with whatever content they seem to have. And I think that's the fair way to do it.
As
acknowledging that people feel very strongly about this, that they're upset, that they're frightened, although frankly,
right, but
it seems
pretty
artificial to me. I mean, you know, it's a merchant who suddenly got, you know, stabbed. And we've had homeless deaths, and you don't hear a peep from these very concerned citizens, other than, oh, another homeless death, you know, or not even that. It doesn't even merit anything. So, and admittedly, homicides are not the rule in Santa Cruz.
Mm-hmm.
No, and that's, so it's not just a matter of deaths, it's a matter of killings. But there are killings of people, and they're, of course, written off as, oh, it's a bad drug deal, you know, that sort of thing. But I guess if a, when a housed person kills a homeless person, I guess it was kind of, you know, a set-up case where you have a person who is homeless is the, I don't know if he is the likely killer, or at least he certainly is the suspect in this case. I want to be, you know, technically fair to him. I don't know what. It seems like it's more difficult. But I, what I'm trying to say is that I think there's a prejudicial distinction because of the perp is considered to be homeless and the victim is housed. Keep talking about this, Thomas. I got a quick take.
Okay,
call.
Sure. Mm-hmm. So I mean, yeah, there's no question about it. Is that there's a hot button issue in Santa Cruz, and the murder of this person who apparently had a lot of connections in the community, and was very well thought of by a lot of people who I guess have a lot of access to media and officials, just like giant red button, and it got pushed. So we have another caller. Hello, caller. Oh. Hello, caller. Hello? Hello? All right. Someone called in, and it was on the second line, and so I wasn't quite sure how to actually answer that. So if they want to call in again, please do so. 6 months from now, where are we going to be? I mean, let's just take this forward 6 months. And the fact is, whatever city policies that actually have any tangible effect. Okay, so we do have a caller. Let's see if I can actually pick this one up. Hello, caller? Okay, so hold on. Let me put you on the air. Did it work this time?
Am I there?
Yes, you're there. Okay, hold on. Let me dial you down a bit. Okay, so, hello.
Okay, here it is.
Uh-huh.
See if you can guess who this is.
Yeah, I know who it is.
No, I mean who I'm going to read about.
Oh.
He eventually pawned all his possessions and actually wound up sleeping on park benches and begging for money. He quickly became a dirty, smelly, unshaven young man wearing tattered clothes. He did not even own an overcoat. In December of 1909, freezing and half-starved, he moved into a homeless shelter. He ate at a soup kitchen operated by the nuns from a nearby convent. Who do you think that's about?
Hello?
Yeah, hi.
Hey, sorry, I missed the last portion of that because I'm getting a whole bunch of calls in now. So who was that?
Did you hear what I did? You hear it?
I heard it all the way up to the point in which you were talking about the person on the park bench.
Okay. In December of 1909, freezing and half starved, he moved into a homeless shelter. He ate at a soup kitchen operated by the nuns from a nearby convent. This is Adolf Hitler.
Uh-huh.
In Vienna. In 1909. You were talking about homeless people that have become renowned, successful. There's one of them.
I guess so. I don't know if I would define that as success. And
well, he was certainly, whatever one thinks about the Führer, he was certainly he achieved world historical greatness.
Yes. Well, yeah. Defining greatness as having an impact on the world, yes. So,
well, how else would you define it?
positive impact on the world.
All right, well, that's different. You're talking about, you know, Mother Teresa or something.
I guess, yeah.
Who had impact, but certainly the Fuhrer had impact.
Yes.
As did, all kinds of individuals. In fact, there's an attraction to characters like Hitler. Take Back Santa Cruz is a, without a civil rights component, is a neo-fascist glee club.
Yeah, I mean, you could certainly characterize, you know, any kind of, like, law and order vigilante-ish type initiative that way.
It's easy to get people to, goose step with the establishment. That's no difficulty. You don't need people to think about anything other than.
Yeah, I'm going to take this call, but keep on talking. Hello?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I have to answer this caller off the air. Or
go ahead. I'll let go.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
Can't hear anything. Hello. Can anybody hear me?
Yeah, sorry.
Okay.
I forgot to turn my microphone up.
I was
dealing with three different things.
Okay, take it slow.
Yeah, so it's very hard to deal with, like, multiple callers on the same time when, like, one's on the air and then someone else is calling in.
The key to it is, Thomas, is don't try to screen them. Just immediately put them on the air.
With the other caller?
Yes.
Oh,
you
okay. That wouldn't be normally what I would do.
I usually
want to ask people if they want to go on the air first.
I know, but I told you I was up for it.
So yeah.
You didn't pick up on that. That's okay. So, hi, Bill. Hi, Bob. How you doing?
Yeah, Bob actually went off the air.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, I had a letter I got from former homeless Black Services Center, Doug Loisel. I wanted to read that letter about two issues.
Sure.
One is just a general issue around homeless Black Services Center crackdown stuff that's happening. And I've gotten more calls in the last 2 weeks than I have really in the last few months about restrictions and abusive behavior by homeless Black Service Center personnel. And by the homeless Black Service Center, I'm talking about Monica Martinez's homeless service center, as she calls it. I understand at least two people have left. Some claim because of improprieties or other abuses. Some say they don't know why. I have no clear information. That's Dan White and Biscotti, Nancy Lou Biscotti, who have been sort of the top shelter program people there. And the reason I mentioned them, for those who are regular listeners probably know, I'm really focused on actually the excuses the city uses to criminalize homeless people. By criminalize, I mean make it illegal for them to sleep, make it illegal for them to sit, make it illegal for them to peacefully and quietly hold up a sign asking for spare change, make it illegal for them to sit in a parking lot, either in or outside a vehicle, where it's illegal not just for homeless people, for anybody, but of course it's homeless people that are more likely to need to do that. So, where am I going with this?
Yeah.
There has been a more extensive number of call-in complaints to me, because I work with this group called HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. I really am hopeful of being able to get this stuff aired so that the voice of the people who are clients out there and members of the homeless community can speak their minds and say what their problems are. And, of course, I do a meeting every Wednesday from 10 to 12. HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, meets at the Sub Rosa, the cafe up at a block from Pacific and Laurel. And I encourage people to come to 703 Pacific and check that out. But there does seem to be, as I've mentioned before, we've seen this police state mentality invading services that are supposed to be protecting homeless people from this kind of bigotry, this kind of vigilante ethic, this kind of NIMBY attitude that is nothing new in American society. It's, you know, it's a cancer, frankly, that's been around for decades. And I do regard it as a cancer. I don't regard, you know, Take Back Santa Cruz as a cancer. I regard them as a misguided group. But the attitude that they have, I do regard as, I don't know, cancer is the wrong word. I don't know if it grows of its own accord. Anyway, the point is I'm getting more complaints, and if we were on the air, we aren't, of course. We're only on the stream. Is that
yes.
true?
Yes. I checked the website this morning, and it said the same thing. So, you know, we're talking to like 15, 20 people
at most, and they can't even tell that. Too bad. I mean, because I understand out there at the Homeless Lack of Services Center, some people do have a radio, and they do listen in, and sometimes they call in, particularly a woman named Andrea, who calls the show, and I hope maybe she'll be able to call today, although because you're probably leaving shortly, she will not be able to realize it's, you know, I mean, she'll get a canned show. That's what we're going to be playing. But anyway, I got these letters from Doug Loisel, who's the former director of the Homeless Lack of Services Center. He's the one who opened up the bathrooms 24 hours, and apparently now they're shut down. They're not shut down, but you can only have access to porta potties if you're not actually in one of their special programs, even though there are bathrooms there that could be accessible to people who are outside and so provide, you know, a public service there. He writes the following. He wrote this in January. Hi, Robert. Sounds like Monica, that's Monica Martinez, was feeling the same pressure that I was feeling at the time I was there. Mostly it came from one of the neighbors, Polar Radiator, I think that's what it was called, across the street. They complained more or less the whole time that I was there. It always surprises me how people think they can mandate things like no loitering zones without any laws or regulations officially passed. In other words, not only was the Homeless Lack of Services Center saying you couldn't be there during the day unless you were picking up your mail or standing in line for a meal or, you know, doing some medical check, but you couldn't be in the area. So the very thing I think I mentioned before, that is, the Homeless Lack of Services Center was supposedly set up as a kind of a refuge for homeless people and, frankly, as a pressure valve to get them out of the downtown area where the merchants felt that their very presence was the economic cause of all their woes or many of their woes or some of their woes. That very thing, of course, was being subverted by the very, I guess it is, a cancerous attitude, which is not in my backyard, not in my backyard. And so we've had this, I know when we put tables up there, they told us on the sidewalk we couldn't do that because it was illegal, and we said, no, it isn't illegal, you know, in fact, it's quite legal. And eventually we got past that, but there seems to be, again, this attitude of criminalizing homeless people, even by the very people who are supposed to be their advocates. And Doug Loisel continues, as you know, your folks have every right to stand on a public sidewalk. That way the Homeless Service Center has power over clients in that circumstance. The only way they have power is that they will mandate that any clients caught loitering will be denied services. Kind of a shitty thing to do, in my opinion. Polar offered to sell their property to the Homeless Service Center, but that never occurred. The one thing that bothered me was the vehicles posted on Coral Street, because the rumor was they were selling drugs. I used to try to shoo them away for that reason, family, shelter, and kids of being in the area. I was unsuccessful as they weren't breaking any laws. I did try to reason with them. Was there only a porta potty there at night during my tenure? No, said Loisel. We opened the bathrooms under the Paul Lee loft. I mean, what was the staff doing at 3 a.m. other than sitting on their bum? Were you under pressure? Was I under pressure, asks Doug Loisel, to set up a no loitering zone has now been done? Yes, but it's a public area. It's not a 7-Eleven. People can be there if they want. Polar bitched and moaned almost daily. Probably the best thing the Homeless Service Center can do is buy the buildings across the street and provide more services, a novel thought. But the Harvey West Association would most likely be very unhappy with that. I wanted to buy those buildings and make it into the winter shelter and stop paying the huge sum of money Homeless Service Center pays the armory annually. We even had an architect and fire department inspect. That's as far as it goes.
Now the city, of course, would like oppose that.
It could be that it did. You have a clear set of appeal procedures for someone evicted from the Homeless Service Center. What were they? That was a question I asked. Were they in writing? Any client that was evicted went through my office. No staff could evict or deny services without my approval. That apparently has changed. The only offense that really got someone banned from the campus were violent acts or serious threats, or maybe chronic, and I mean chronic, violations. Any client could come in and talk to me if I wasn't in a meeting. I saw a lot of clients while I was there. I have this damn thing about liking people that I just can't seem to shake. I think we did have them in writing, but I can't really remember. I think it was a fair system. I think if people think you are on their side, they tend to do what you ask them because they believe your requests are in their best interests. Legitimate authority rather than power. What a concept. Hope that helps. Write or call sometime. That's a letter from Doug in January, and I'm really sorry I didn't read it at the time I got it, because it's it answers some interesting questions and raises issues that needed to be raised. He also recently wrote me a letter regarding specifically the most recent round of hysteria that you were talking about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm looking for that letter now. Having some trouble finding it. Just a minute. I can perhaps give an update, if it's okay with you, on what went down at the recent hearing for the Santa Cruz 11 defendant, Robert North.
Sure.
I wasn't there. I was, you know, I just got out of the hospital where I was getting some treatment for an intestinal problem, where I'm probably going to get some surgery. But and that's one of the reasons I'm not in the studio. But I did get secondhand reports, and those reports seem to be pretty accurate. And I also talked to my attorney, who was there. And the issue about the Santa Cruz 11, which is a group of people who are charged with, I guess it's aiding and abetting a trespass and vandalism, which is to say the occupation, the political occupation, temporarily, of a vacant bank building, 3.5-year vacant bank building on 75 River Street, across from the occupied and active bank building, the Wells Fargo, which apparently also owns the 70 or leases the 75 River Street property. We're accused of, we're actually accused of being in the building. That's really the only crime. They've turned it into a two felony, two misdemeanor, conspiracy, aiding and abetting birthday package. And mm-hmm. It involved 11 people. Six of them have already been dismissed in preliminary hearings, though that's not a final decision. It depends on how ruthless and pig-headed the district attorney of Bob Lee's DA, Rebecca Young, is. But the fact is, at least more than half of already the charges have been found to be inadequately backed by evidence. The evidence they have in the cases that we've seen so far, including in my case, is that we went in the building to report, to observe, or to speak with the people inside. And that involved hundreds of members of the community who did that. And, of course, only 11 of them, high-profile activists, are being charged, which is kind of selective and, I think, really telling as
consistent.
To... consistent. What's that?
It's consistent with past behavior.
Yeah, and it's also, unfortunately, consistent with this growing, ominous wave of attacks on Occupies throughout the country. That you see it in Chicago, the attacks on the Occupies and activists opposing the NATO conference there, police raids without warrants to people's homes, the kind of huge protest zones that are set up. But in any case, what happened on Friday in the hearing was that we demanded that the district attorney's sort of lone ranger, so to speak, Rebecca Young, had repeatedly promised to give us the video that would show what the police recorded over the 3 days of occupation of the building. Because it appears to me that the people that actually planned this thing, and I wasn't a part of that, so I can't really tell who did it, but, you know, none of those people are being charged that I know of, and I don't even know who they are, but I know the people being charged aren't the people who were involved. I mean, at least that's my conclusion. And there are all kinds of other people who weren't involved that aren't being charged. And the question is, why? So to raise that issue in court, we need to have the video of all the people that went in and out. Because the police are claiming that if they could identify them, that's really what they were trying to do. And therefore, you know, they put the video up on some websites. Some video got put up on websites by the DA himself and by the police department. The police department, I think, put up photos. The DA put up videos saying, come, identify these criminals in our community. And I was upset by that, and I wrote a letter to Chief Vogel, and I said, You know, I'm no criminal. What are you doing with pictures of people, you know, on the website, including me, myself? And the point also is that people like council member Catherine Byers, former mayor, were also in the building, repeatedly in the building. And therefore, you know, why aren't they being charged if it's a crime to walk into a building to see what's going on when the police are standing around and doing nothing to either stop people from going in or arrest them as they come out or demand they leave, and if they don't leave, take them out in custody? That didn't happen at any point during, well, actually, it's not true. At one point, it did happen, apparently, reportedly by the news media, it did happen. But at that point, I suppose, the people who did not leave might have justifiably been arrested if that was the biggest issue. Although, for me, the biggest issue was Wells Fargo's destruction of, I don't know how many tens of thousands of families and homes throughout the country, and its continuing destruction through these phony foreclosures and manipulated loans and so forth. So at this hearing, we tried to get the video. We wanted to see it.
Mm-hmm.
And we tried to get it. We've been trying to get it for months. We've been asking for it, and Rebecca Young has been saying, oh, yeah, I've got it here on my desk. I'll send it over. Or, oh, gee, I have to get it. It'll be downloaded soon. And this has happened at least three or four times. So she's either out of the loop, clueless, or lying. You know, it's hard to say what's happening. I don't want to, you know, mischaracterize her. It looks to me like she's inept and completely out of her depth in this whole process. So it's hard to say what, you know, what's really going on with her. She has to face batteries of lawyers. She's one DA fighting 11 lawyers and losing every step of the way. But at the same time as she's losing, some people have lost their jobs, some people have lost their housing, one person has attempted suicide, another person has gone into the hospital, say hello to me.
Mm-hmm.
And this has had its consequences throughout, you know, the community, and I, as well as the fact that protest, I think, has been chilled as a consequence of this whole thing, and that, of course, is the point, I think, of these prosecutions. So the DA has been told, get those videos by Monday, 5 o'clock. But unfortunately, Paul Burdick, the judge, did not say he would grant a continuance if there was not that presentation. We also requested that there's a preliminary hearing that's due next week, or actually a week from Monday. And that we wanted, we said, we can't go to a preliminary hearing without videos. And he said, well, you'll have to file a motion if the videos don't appear by Monday. It may be Burdick, who is the same judge who has dismissed all the other charges, or in all the other defendants' cases, essentially is saying, you don't need the videos, because if I'm hearing them, I'll dismiss them anyway. But that's not clear, and it's also not clear that he'll be hearing the cases. So we're kind of in a, those of us who are, I'm with the last group of five in the Santa Cruz 11 who are still charged, and we are not sure what to do. And it's put a lot of people under some serious pressure. I mean, one defendant is considering pleading to the charges because his attorney is simply a bad attorney. He's already been recused in what's called a Marsden motion. This is Brent Adams' attorney, Ryan Murphy, who refuses to meet with him, refuses to email him, refuses to talk to him by phone, regards him as guilty. It's outrageous. He's, you know, completely unprofessional behavior. And Burdick, to his discredit, Judge Burdick, when he heard this motion to disqualify Murphy, didn't do so, wouldn't do so. It's, again, I think it's the good old boys sticking together in the local court system. On the positive side, first of all, I mean, we will know at 5 o'clock whether, and none of us have any confidence at all that Young will suddenly pull these videos out of her hat. I mean, there's supposedly 20 hours of video, which one detective has testified under penalty of perjury exists, and then more video that hasn't even been downloaded 4 months later from the police servers that's still sitting in the police department, in spite of repeated requests. So, you know, we're hopeful that, again, to me, this is to simply to show the community the outrageousness of the authority and power and what it can do to twist people around in the wind, kind of at their whim, and in a way perhaps anyway, being the person that's twisting in the wind, I don't like it.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other thing that happened on Friday was Attorney Ed Frye, who is the attorney for what I call Ground Zero Gary Johnson, is a man who's been sentenced to 2.5 years in jail for sleeping outside on a bench with the sign, "Sleep is not a crime," in front of the courthouse. This is Santa Cruz. You know, I think it might be, I don't know, China or Iran or, I don't know, some weird foreign country. But no, this is Santa Cruz. He went into court in a sweatsuit in solidarity with his client rather than the business suit or the suit and tie that attorneys are customarily wear. He was warned by the judge not to do that. He ignored the warning, and he was then sentenced. He was held in contempt, or sentenced to a contempt hearing, or directed to come to this hearing, which also happened on Friday. And on Friday, he went and he apologized to the court, but he pointed out that jurors, though Gary Johnson's defense, to some extent, was that there were no openings in the homeless service center at that time, so he had no alternatives but to sleep outside, as well as the fact that it's a political right to be in front of the courthouse with a sign. In spite of that fact, one juror was heard to say to another, "Oh, it doesn't, you know, he's got a rich attorney, looks like, because the guy's all dressed up in a business suit." So, and this would, of course, cut against his right to, now, the impression to be giving the jury. So Ed, in solidarity, dressed down because he didn't want to forward the illusion. Ed, of course, is not only not rich, he's about to lose everything he has in another case.
Mm-hmm.
And so he, that was why he did it. He then apologized for any confusion about this. I understand. I haven't read his speech, and I intend to post it on Santa Cruz Indie Media. And so he was, you know, the judge said, okay. I think the judge reportedly dressed him down further and then let him go. The judge did made a few nasty cracks about him, stating that he had heard that he had asked to, Ed is appealing a case. He himself has been sentenced to 6 months in jail for sleeping outside in a demonstration 2 years ago, which Ed himself set up outside the courthouse in solidarity with Robert Blind Bear Facer, who died recently. He's the man who canoed all the way down from Alaska. He's the Amish minister, 61 years old, tall fellow, 63 years old when he died, actually, here in Santa Cruz a few weeks ago. And Ed was sentenced to jail for that. John Gallagher in Department 2, and this is where all these hearings were held against Ed Frye and Gary Johnson and the sleep crime cases. Gallagher claimed that he kind of, in a kind of a nasty aside, told Ed, apparently, and again, I wasn't there, but he said that, you know, in essence, he was saying, "Your appeals are fruitless. I heard you say that, you know, I heard you ask the other judges," because apparently they were all at a judge's meeting in a kind of some sort of conclave, and Ed had spoken to a couple of judges saying that, you know, he hoped that you, sort of a find against Gallagher's, because Gallagher is making rulings about anybody who falls asleep anywhere in the, I guess it's anywhere in the state, but as far as he's concerned, it's anywhere in the county, can be charged with a misdemeanor unless they can prove that they have the permission of the owner of the property. And that means if it's public property, you think it belongs to the public, but no, you have to get the permission of the bureaucrat, who's the owner. So if you fall asleep on a public sidewalk, that's a violation of 647E in this community and anywhere in California, according to Judge Gallagher's ruling. That ruling was appealed by Attorney Ed Frye, and Gallagher sort of victoriously snickered to Ed that, although I don't know how he put it, you see, you lost that appeal. And so, anyway, Ed got off for the contempt, but he's still facing 6 months in jail, and Gary Johnson at any time can be jailed for 2.5 years. These are real concerns that affect real people,
mm-hmm.
not people who are being hoisted up over people's heads and as you know, with bloody rags and the dead who have already been murdered and all that stuff. These are real threats in a real vigorous, ongoing, methodical, mechanical, robotic way against all homeless people in our community, and house people who are likely to become homeless or transients or passers-by. And so that's why I think we need to really keep the focus on these issues. Mm-hmm. And I appreciate your taking the time to do this, Thomas.
I'm going to see if I can put on one of your old shows in the Winamp, and then I'm going to take off now because I want to, like, go to the memorial thing.
Becky wanted you to announce that. You want to tell people what it's about? Do you have the information on that?
Sure. I have to let me pull it up. Damn, freaking slow computer.
Yeah, it's very slow, that studio computer.
So there's a memorial service for Billy R. Comer, also known as Billy Budd, who was David Silva's godson, who came here with David Silva to Santa Cruz a few months ago. And the young man, I believe, was in his 20s. I did not know him very well. I met him a couple times in passing when I was talking with David. And when he came to my wife's store to pick up something from me that I left for him there, or charge his cell phone, etc. And apparently he went into the hospital Monday before last, I believe, after some kind of family reunion. And I don't know what the cause is, but he passed away. So
I also know that because David called into my show a couple weeks ago, both of them were disqualified from the Homeless Lack of Services Center Pauli shelter program because they came in late, because David Silva, who's a HIV person, had an appointment he had to keep.
Mm-hmm.
And they were both simply thrown out of the shelter, and he just... This is one of numerous examples of this sort of authoritarian attitude that I was concerned was developing in the shelter. I've been concerned is developing around the nation. And I also see this as, you know, this recent hysteria is simply more of the same.
Well, I think, having talked with David numerous times over the past few months, given him various assistance at various points, and I know a lot of other people have given him assistance too, that, like, the idea that Santa Cruz is somehow welcoming to poor people or makes it easy is just freaking ridiculous.
It's particularly...
David's HIV positive, which is, of course, not a good thing, but has some advantages in terms of obtaining resources and the level and the priority. He's a veteran, and that gives him some advantages. And he's also a very knowledgeable person who's been engaged with this whole system and is somewhat familiar with how everything works. And it has took him, like, literally, like, months and months of constant running around from here to there to there to there to even get a basic level of services that he was already essentially entitled to and had been using, elsewhere. And so I look at that. And then I look at and I think about how would your average person put into that situation do? And the answer is, they would find it impossible. They probably would have thrown up their hands a long time ago.
David has also mentioned in my show that the defunding of SCAP, Santa Cruz AIDS Project, has resulted in a lot of deaths, and that he holds Coonerty and the city council that is currently pandering to the latest hysteria responsible for that. It's true.
Yeah. I'm not sure how much memorial happening.
It's
happening at 1717 Felt Street, the Spiritual Living Center, and it's at 10 a.m. So I have like 10 minutes to be there. They're going to have a meditation at 10 a.m. and a memorial candle and a service at 10:30.
Oh, you'll make it for the service for sure.
Yes.
Can I, before you go, read this last thing from Loisel on the issue?
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
He writes about what he was reading in the Sentinel about this latest stuff that I said we shouldn't talk about, so here I go talking about it again. Honest to God, writes Doug Loisel, former homeless lack of services center director who actually opened up the bathrooms and fought to expand the services center and fought to stop the kind of criminalization around the edges of the service center that the city was trying to foist on the service center for homeless people. Honest to God, I read about this issue this morning and was opening my email to drop you a line about this just now. And he's talking about the specific proposals. Do you have those proposals in front of you of the city council to set up ID checks for people?
I had that article. I've read that article several times. There's a number of proposals. I think what you're referring to is the proposal to expand the Sydney ordinance that now applies to hotels and motels, saying that their guest list must be available to the police if the police are looking for. I'm not exactly sure what the police are entitled to do or not, or typically do with these lists. But basically, you know, make that entire guest list available to the police for their review under some process. And then something about, like, requiring everybody who uses the homeless services center to have an ID card separate and apart from their state ID. And the homeless service center was talking about, like, maybe putting a photo on it or something. And, again, I'm not exactly sure what the point of that would be and exactly who would have to have it, because they said that there's already a program that's been in place for like 9 months that like 300 people using services already have something like that.
And then there's a third thing. I've grabbed the Sentinel article that says no new homeless service facilities in the city, and
Which may or may not be related to some kind of proposal that the board is working on to create like a some kind of long-term housing that would like get chronically homeless people off the street, which, you know, would be completely counterproductive, but of course completely predictable.
What Doug Loisel writes is this about that proposal.
And then there's a couple other elements of it that are completely pointless, ranting about the jail and somehow proposing that, like, money from somewhere be given to people who can have tickets to give them bus tickets to go somewhere else if they want to. I mean, this is all the same shit that they've been recycling for years, essentially.
Meet regularly with homeless staff to identify homeless individuals who are engaging in criminal behavior. That, of course, can be used to involve things like sleeping outside, which is criminal behavior, sitting downtown next to a building, which is criminal behavior.
Yeah, I mean, what's the homeless services staff going to know about people engaging in criminal behavior? I mean, if someone's engaging in serious criminal behavior, the staff is going to sit there.
It's not about serious criminal behavior.
I know.
That's the point. So, I mean, anyway, I'm looking at the proposals. There are 8 of them. Actually, there are probably 10 of them if you count the first one, which is divided into 3s, which has to do with the ID system, registry protocol to give police and service providers a sense of who's using the facility, prioritizing services for residents of Santa Cruz County over people from outside the area with an exception for winter. 2 is designate a police officer to meet regularly, as I mentioned before, to identify those who are engaging in criminal behavior. Not accept any new homeless service facilities in the city of Santa Cruz. Work with property owners of public housing to screen current tenants for serious criminal history. Partnering with the county to expand mental health funding. Expand the Homeward Bound. That's kind of funny. Program for homeless people, using San Francisco's Home to Nowhere, to provide more bus tickets, as you mentioned, requesting county jail return their prisoners to the community of origin.
That's not going to happen.
And ask the judicial system to provide a monthly list of offenders who have failed to appear in court so the city attorney can prosecute them under the city's repeat offender law. Now, we're talking about people who didn't show up for 3 sleeping tickets.
If you look at all this, this is pandering, and it's actually counterproductive if they actually seriously wanted to
I mentioned
reduce...
them because I want to read Lizelle's letter, and I want to give you a chance to get out of the studio.
Yeah.
So here's his letter about those proposals, and this is what he says. checking the guest list in hotels, having homeless people carry identification cards, homeless service center running background checks on suspicious homeless persons in collaboration with staff, and Monica Martinez's clear alignment with city government and business is absurd. I can't fathom the lack of constitutional basis for what they're proposing, as well as the fact that it won't work. I had no idea that Sheriff Joe Arpaio moved to Santa Cruz. That's the guy who's under federal investigation, actually charges, I believe, not sure which, for his brutal behavior against immigrants in Arizona. I guess it's okay to run background checks on low-income persons seeking shelter. The Homeless Services Center spent $5,000 in the program last year, and only 5% of those who were given a bus ticket out of Santa Cruz are known to have returned, according to Monica Martinez. Lizelle comments, I find it fascinating how people can state statistics are facts that are totally impossible to verify. Can you ask her how she knows only 5% return to Santa Cruz? We believe that under Monica Martinez's leadership, the Homeless Services Center has dramatically improved to create more accountability and effective programming for homeless individuals. They so say council members Robinson, Bryant, and Coonerty. At which point, Loiselle responds, how do you measure accountability and effective programming, by the way? It's like the people who say the county is safer under one political party or another. It makes no sense because there's no way to measure it. Oh, and just the thought, nobody was stabbed to death when I was the director of the Homeless Lack of Services Center, though he calls it the Homeless Services Center. I felt very bad for the woman who was murdered, and there is no explanation that I can think of for why these things happen. But to target the homeless population because of what happened is not right. This was an isolated incident perpetrated by a man who clearly suffered from significant mental illness that in no way reflects the homeless population. Even the article admits none of these proposals in and of themselves would have stopped Charles Edwards against him.
That's the whole...
But if adopted, these approaches will bring more accountability and targeted resources for the challenges facing our community, the council member said in his statement. It is very disturbing indeed. Feel free to read my comments on the air if you wish. That's Doug Loiselle, probably the best homeless services center director, only there for a year and a half because he retired under a cloud of charges from a previous incident that had nothing to do with his directorship or his capabilities there. Thomas, thank you for letting me talk on the air. If you can, let me talk to you very briefly when we get off the air, because I want you to give you some direction as to what to, you need to put on a couple of shows after mine. You already got a show of mine on the air ready to go.
I'm getting there.
Okay. And I want to, again, encourage people. There is a meeting of Occupy Santa Cruz today at 2 o'clock on the courthouse steps. I'll probably not be there because I myself am recuperating or trying to and talking too much. There's a meeting of the HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, on Wednesday at 10 o'clock in front of the, and actually in the middle of the Sub Rosa Cafe where people can get free coffee. I hope I will be there, that I'll feel better. And I believe coming into the, there's going to be a shitty council meeting on the 22nd. So if people want to go to the shitty council meeting and, you know, you get to see all the bigots line up and you can line up in the other direction, 3 o'clock is likely the time for the city council meeting. 5 o'clock is the anal communications, or the oral communications, as they call it, online special ghetto half hour where people are allowed to speak briefly before being shooed away. So that's coming up, too. And there are other items. If you're interested in being a part of the actual movement that the Santa Cruz 11 prosecutions are designed to stir, you can go to the Occupy Santa Cruz website There's ongoing actions of different kinds. There actually is more activism, I think, in the community than there was a year ago because of the Occupy movement. But as I said, we are facing a crackdown all over the country, although courts, and I would have talked about this on the air, are repeatedly acquitting people, although there are some exceptions, of the phony charges that police and authorities are using. Still, I think that these arrests are having their impact, and I encourage people, try not to be deterred, get out there, stand up for these issues, and don't be scared. I saw a stupid article, a letter by Micah Posner, who's running for city council and should know better, stating that he's afraid now to walk around his Ocean Street neighborhood. Why she should be more afraid now than 3 weeks ago, I don't know. It seems, you know, if there were, you know...
I lived on Lower Barson Street for about a year and a half.
Yeah, I mean, he's pandering to this attitude, and if he really feels that way, he shouldn't be running for city council. He's the wrong man to be even thinking about that. In fact, I intend to call him and pistol whip him on the phone.
Okay.
Yeah, let me talk to you once you've gotten off the air, and I want to thank everybody for listening briefly and apologize for the old show. Maybe it'll be okay to check out a few moments in the past. Thank you, Thomas. I'll wait for you to...
Okay. All right. All right, so I'm going to put on some transitional music while I queue up the shows, and then we're going to go from there, okay?
Just tell me how this feels. As I bend your knees like they're tempered steel. And I thought they'd stay, but your legs grew straight. From the frame on this door, I saw you walk away. Those crooked lines that we put in our heads. that spat us up, but in turn tore us apart. And now I'm here, gonna be your lonely hot boy.
Collection. And lastly, check out the books and read them. We love to see the books in circulation, so check out Books at Sub Rosa for 2 weeks or more. This brought to you by the Anarchist Librarians at the Sub Rosa Cafe.
Hi, this is Jello Biafra. If you're tired of propaganda and boring music on the radio, well, there is Free Radio Santa Cruz.
We have a special guest with us today.
That's not how you talk, Heath.
I know who that is.
Ski Master, the Caveat County Street Anarchist, right here on 101.3.
I don't have to use your name, but it bothers me knowing you personally that you talk like this on the radio. I talk to you so much. You have all these things to say. You're a very interesting person. And you get on the radio, and you have this whole radio affect. Like, you're like some AM radio
affect. And, well, not today. Now coming up is Bathrob Spears Broadsides on Free Radio Santa Cruz. We have a special guest with us today. We'll be getting into her, so to speak, in a moment. She'll be signing in, and maybe, who knows, singing in, perhaps. You never can tell.
Maybe. Could be.
Yes. let's see. Is your mic working? Say something.
Hello, hello, hello.
It's working. It's
okay.
Working. Cool.
Okay, good.
Let's have a brief musical break. No, we'll be back. Stay tuned. That was a quickie from Sarah Marlowe. I guess it wasn't that quick, 5 minutes long at least, but it went quick. You're, of course, tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz at 101.3 FM, and that one was called Not in Our Name. I think I played it before, but hey, you just heard it again. In the studio with me is a guest who actually just called me today, freshly arrived from the north, going to be talking about stuff that's been going on. She's been a street performer here. I don't know much about her other life, but perhaps we'll learn something about it in the next hour. Maybe getting a call from attorney David Beauvais of Berkeley. He is my attorney in the case of the Santa Cruz 11, which has gotten a lot of media play in the last week or two. There's a little bit in this Good Times, which I actually pointed out to Elizabeth here. That's the name of my guest. Hello, Elizabeth.
Hello, hello.
And he may call in because he's done conspiracy cases before, defended people accused of conspiracy, which I'm accused of, felonious conspiracy, to trespass, to vandalize, to destroy everything that is decent in Santa Cruz. Actually, simply to put a feather in the hat of Bob Lee and a smile back on the face of Police Chief Kevin Vogel. But it's all about the River Street occupation back in November, which I've talked about a lot, and so I'll put that one aside for the moment and talk about you a little bit, Elizabeth, and what's been cooking with you as you sip this. I never liked that kind
of
tea.
It's a mint medley.
Is it really a mint medley, or is it just a pseudo mint medley?
It's more of a pseudo, I think, yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of...
not so great.
Yeah, but you know, it's hot, and I guess it can lubricate the throat. Mm-hmm. So welcome to Back to Santa Cruz.
Thank you.
You were here, what, 4 years ago? Or?
2 years ago.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it might seem like 4 years ago, but it was 2 years ago.
Yeah, I haven't got really a sense of it. Last time we ran into each other, you were on the street?
Yeah.
You were singing?
Yeah, I believe I was probably playing the guitar and singing right by New Leaf, I think.
They weren't hassling you for singing near New Leaf?
Not at that point, no. They didn't hassle me.
Good.
Yeah.
Officer Winston didn't come up and tell you to move along, or you were too close to a news rack, perhaps, although it's legal to be right next to a news rack.
Well, I did get hassled sometimes, but that particular time, I don't think I was hassled, no.
Mm-hmm. That's good. Yeah. So you're a singer here, and then you took off for Oregon?
Yeah, I went back to Oregon. Well, I met someone here. We were living on his boat, and in Moss Landing Harbor, and I got pregnant, and so I went back to Oregon, and had the baby in a hospital there in Southern Oregon.
Medford, perhaps?
Close to there. Roseburg, not too far.
Sounds
vaguely
familiar.
Yeah. And the Child Protective Services came in and took the baby because I had to stay at a domestic violence shelter because I had really nowhere to go. And so they took the baby saying that I was a homeless woman, which...
In Oregon, that's enough condition to take away
a child? I guess there was, you know, there was other things that they said that were untrue, you know, but they did say homeless was, you know, correct in the sense that I was staying in a shelter, but there's a lot of corruption in the CPS in that particular county, and there's a lot of money to be made in foster family care. So what they do is they take these babies, put them in foster family care, and it gives a lot of money to the economy there. It's like the government has a lot of money, you know? So that's one thing they can do to support, to help support the economy. Or
did you have how long did this whole process take?
It's been about a year. I'm still haven't signed the papers, and I may never sign the papers.
Let's see who's on the line. That could be the very same attorney I mentioned before. Hi there, you're on Free Radio. Can you hear me?
Hello there. This is David calling in.
Hey there, David. The infamous David Beauvais of Berkeley, perhaps. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. Try these.
I think the word is notorious.
Notorious? Yeah, well, you say you hate the word notorious, or you find that an apt title?
Oh, I was saying it was an apt title.
Ah, good, good. Well, the more notorious you are, perhaps the more money your progeny will make off your remains. Who knows? I think you have a son. I've never met your son, but welcome to Free Radio.
Welcome.
Yeah.
In the studio with me is Elizabeth. Elizabeth, David. David, Elizabeth.
Hi, David.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Good.
So Elizabeth has just been telling us that she's had her child snatched by CPS up in Roseburg, Oregon, a year ago, and she's been fighting it because she was in a women's domestic violence shelter and so termed homeless. There's probably a couple other things you haven't told us that they're accusing you of.
Sure, there are. I mean, I'm bipolar, and that's never been much of an issue, other than
bipolar. Does that mean you go up and buy Frosty products up north?
Yeah, that's exactly what it means. But yeah, so that's another another thing that they're accusing me of, which is not illegal, and I take something, and it's nothing that's been a real problem, but now they're bringing it out with I'm a crazy transient, which is basically what they said on the stand. I'm a crazy transient, which is pretty ridiculous, but they did, and now I'm stuck in this this battle.
And your child is being held in a foster home somewhere.
Yeah,
What's his name?
Isaiah.
Isaiah. David, how many CPS cases have you dealt with in the past?
Oh, I would say quite a few. I mean, I've dealt with them on two levels. One is representing parents in juvenile dependency proceedings like the one that Elizabeth seems to be describing.
Uh-huh.
And then the other one is bringing affirmative cases for civil rights violations against CPS when they violate constitutional rights, which happens quite frequently.
Yeah, it does. I've done a lot of research since this happened, and I've heard about some really awful things. And it is a civil rights case because ultimately I'm bipolar. I have nothing to hide, and that's a civil rights violation because just because I have a diagnosis that they think they can come in and take the child. And, if there was some record of abuse, I could understand, or even, a criminal record, maybe I could understand, or drugs, but none of those are accurate, And so, for me, it's been really hellish, honestly.
You put your finger on something that's important. The juvenile courts are there to protect children from abuse and neglect, and just because a parent has a diagnosis, doesn't turn them into a bad parent.
Exactly.
Just as a parent might have a criminal record, doesn't turn them into a bad parent.
Yeah, I know.
So what has to be looked at in all of these cases is whether or not that diagnosis contributes to a risk of harm to a child.
Exactly.
And that is something that oftentimes would require expert testimony, as well as some facts, to show that the child is indeed at risk because of that diagnosis.
Right.
But bipolar is something that can be controlled.
Yeah.
Medication.
Mm-hmm.
And if the parent is on the medication, taking the medication, then no risk to the child.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I'm no fan of medication myself. Are you thoroughly medicated there?
Well, I do take... lithium, which is,
Does that help you?
Yeah, it does. It evens me out. And, I've never been ashamed. I don't think it's anything to be ashamed of. Yeah. So I have mood swings. Everybody does. Mine may be a little more than...
I have no mood swings myself.
Right. Right. Mm-hmm. But it's just alarming what kind of... what kind of power they have and how... I'm caught up in this whole thing, and it's just unbelievable, and I may never get him back. I mean, that's the truth of it. I've had to deal with that reality already. I may never be able to get him back because, my lawyers
my lawyer hasn't really been doing that much.
Court appointed, or did you pay for him?
Well, actually, I got a court appointed attorney who did nothing, and now I have another attorney that I'm paying for, but I'm running out of money. So, yeah, they're doing more than the court appointed attorney, but it's just so much money.
Well, you know, this is an interesting point. At least what I've seen here, the patterns that I've seen with CPS, particularly in the juvenile court arena, is that all of the players, the attorneys for the children, the attorneys for the parents, the attorneys for the county, they have this kind of esprit de corps and this cooperative spirit, which is, it cuts against our normal adversarial system of justice. In fact, in California, there's a statute that says that these courts are not supposed to be adversarial. They're supposed to, you know, be just kind of cooperative, let's work together, and you know, for the good of all, especially the children.
Yeah.
But the reality of it is that the children, that the parents, especially when they have court-appointed lawyers, who are, you know, in there on bunches of cases, that have lots of cases to do,
yeah,
possibly treat each case as if you're fighting for your client.
Yeah.
Immediately get the parents to admit petitions and go along with the system and say, if you do it this way, you'll get your children back faster.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of parents who should not be caught up in that system just never get to trial. A juvenile court trial, you know, what they call a jurisdiction hearing here in California, is a rarity.
Mm-hmm.
It's extremely rare. Almost all cases are settled there. And then the parents have to do the case plan, and years go by, and there's a lot of room for people to argue that the parents didn't cooperate with the case plan, or they did something, you know, they shouldn't have done. And it just perpetuates itself to the point where children end up being adopted out.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's this whole financial incentive to keep children out of the home. And the way that works is that federal dollars go into providing funds for foster care, and they love to make kids have special needs because they get more money if the kid has special needs.
Yeah.
Force the kids into those little pegs.
Uh-huh.
And then if they can adopt them out, they get a bonus.
Yep.
So the whole financial incentives are set to keep the children from coming back home.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
What was your situation like? I was interrupting you. Did you want to say something, Elizabeth?
No.
Can you, do you want to go into some of the details of how this happened? Are you comfortable talking about that?
Sure. Well, what happened was, you know, I didn't have the father there because the father had been abusive. So the birth certificate.
Physically abusive?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so his name wasn't on the birth certificate, and they knew that I had stayed at a shelter, and I didn't have many people there with me. At one point, I was all alone after the birth, which, you know, wasn't good. But and then I had had a little tiff with one of the nurses there who was rude to me, and then I suddenly found child welfare coming into my room, and they talked to me for about 10, maybe 15 minutes, and said they were going to make their decision. And then they called my mom, which my mom and I have had like a long-standing kind of feud and stuff. And then they came back and took Isaiah. So it was really, it really had a lot to do with the fact that they talked to my mother. And
how old was Isaiah when this happened?
He was about like a day old.
Wow.
Yeah. So it was really, it was horrible. And yeah.
What time for a child to be with?
Yeah, definitely.
This is a year ago, yeah?
Yeah, this is a year ago. And
have you seen Isaiah since?
I've seen him. I have visitation with him, yeah, which is nice.
Did they have a warrant?
A warrant?
Yeah.
No.
They didn't have a court order to take him.
No. Well, when they took him, they didn't give me any paperwork. They just took him. And then 2 days later at the trial or at the hearing, they gave me some paperwork, But, I mean, the trial was a joke. The girl got up on the stand, who was from CPS, and she said, well, I heard that this woman goes around to Christian churches saying she's a Christian. I heard that she uses the elderly and all of this stuff. Obviously, lies, but, you know, she heard it from somewhere, I guess my mom or somebody. And she said all these things that were clearly gossip. It was just gossip. It was literally gossip that she said on the stand. And then the judge said, you know, ruled for them to take my child. It wasn't like this woman has a criminal history or this woman has abused so and so and so and so. It wasn't that at all. It was just defaming my character. And then they took my child. So I mean, there's no justice there. I mean, all hearsay. It was all hearsay. So
did you appeal that?
I didn't even know, like with my public defender, I didn't even know you could appeal it.
Yeah, I get these kinds of things all the time when people come and talk to me about their cases. That they're not told what their legal rights are. They don't know they can appeal. They don't know they have avenues that they can take. And, you know, it sounds to me like your child was taken without a warrant. That's a violation of the Fourth Amendment for the child. It's a violation of your parental rights.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, because the child wasn't in immediate danger of physical injury.
Yeah.
What the standard is. And so they violated that. So many of my cases are brought on that issue alone. The fact that they came in and took a child that's not in danger. I'm getting ready to file one tomorrow where they came in and took a child at 4 o'clock in the morning and was asleep in his bed and was with mom because the dad had been abusive to the kid and the kid went home with mom.
Whoa.
The worker's blessing. And then for some reason she changed her mind and at 4 o'clock in the morning came with the police and took the kid away.
Wow.
Now, is it...
And that same family was due in family court that very morning where a judge could have fixed all of this.
Uh-huh.
With it. But instead, they got into this juvenile court dependency stuff.
Wow.
What state was that, David?
That was in California.
Have you ever been up in Oregon, done any cases up there?
No, but I know that there are problems in Oregon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The reason I know it is because I have people from Oregon who call me, and there was a case that went to the U.S. Supreme Court last year from Oregon called Camarena versus Green that involved some of these issues as well.
So what kind of resources are out there for moms or dads whose kids are stolen from them or taken from them unlawfully or abruptly or whatever by CPS? And is there an online resource? Is there a particular place they can begin to research this?
There are websites that have stories. Fightcps.com is one. And I know there are others out there. So there are places you can go to read about stuff, but there's not very much by way of support for you in terms of a tangible representation. I think there's about 8 lawyers in California that actually sue CPS. I'm 12.5% of those. And the need is far beyond the resources that we have.
So if I wanted to sue or... I mean, I have to have some, I can't have a court-appointed attorney for that, right? Or
no, you would basically hire a civil lawyer who would take it on contingency.
Okay.
And some attorneys will advance costs for clients, some don't, or there'll be some kind of deal where maybe you pay part of the cost or even none of the cost, depending on the lawyer.
Okay.
David, do you have connections with lawyers in Oregon who do sue, are willing to stand up to CPS?
I know one lawyer there, and I don't want to mention that person's name on the air, but if somebody, if Elizabeth would like to know who that person is, she can send me an email.
Okay.
Robert, you have my email.
Sure, I'll give you the email, Elizabeth.
Tell her who that is. But, yeah, there's not that many lawyers around who do this kind of work. That's too bad, too.
Yeah, it is too bad because this is a real serious problem. It's much more serious than I realized.
Any advocacy groups that either of you know about for people who are in this situation, you know, like client groups who people have gotten together and found, you know, some kind of solidarity and at least sharing stories and sharing resources and that sort of thing?
Yeah, there are some things out there, and you know, occasionally there are demonstrations that are brought, you know, in various places. They'll actually take the streets, and now they're relatively small demonstrations because most people don't realize what a problem this really is.
Uh-huh.
It becomes a problem when it happens to you.
Yeah.
But the public perception, you know, largely is that this is that CPS agencies are there to do good for children, and it's almost this attitude like, how dare you even suggest, along with the way the system is operating.
Right.
And they operate with impunity because the courts are not open to the public. And so you rarely have any kind of journalistic expose. There was actually one in the San Jose Mercury News a few years ago because a reporter was allowed into the juvenile court for a day. She was so appalled by what she saw because it's such a factory operation. It's an assembly line.
Yeah.
You know, they give you 10 minutes per case.
Yeah.
And there are so many cases that there's nothing good can come out of a system like that.
No.
Well, there's the presiding judge of the Los Angeles Superior Court named Nash, Michael Nash, is trying to open up the system, and he's made new rules for the L.A. County Court, which basically creates the presumption that these courts will be open, you know, except in extraordinary circumstances. There's some movement to change that, but I think that until these courts can see the light of day, these abuses will continue. But if people can get in and monitor what's going on, like they do with the other courts, then maybe some progress will be made in people understanding what's really going on there.
What about whistleblowers? I mean, you know, we've seen with WikiLeaks and the, you know, the revelation of the murdering from the air American forces, shooting down Iraqis and so forth. Has there been much expose from inside, you know, David?
You know, it's really hard because of the confidentiality law. Actually, it is a crime to disclose juvenile records without court order. And parents who have tried to, you know, publicly advocate their own cases are often punished for that in the court.
Yeah.
Even to the point of gag orders being issued and that sort of thing.
Wow.
Yeah, so it gets pretty dicey. Most parents are already traumatized by what's gone on with taking in their children, but they don't have the resources or the fortitude to even take on that kind of a challenge. I have had some clients who have done it. I mean, the very first case I ever had, my client was immediately went very public with the situation. And I think ultimately we did prevail in that case, and I think ultimately we prevailed because she did that.
That's good.
Now, they just were so afraid of her that they decided to back down, but it took them about a year and a half before they did.
What was her name?
I can't give you her name.
Even though she went public?
Well, I would rather not mention her name without her permission.
Fair enough.
This happened quite a while ago, and I don't know what her current feeling is about it. If you do legal research, you'll find that there are a number of cases online involving CPS abuses. Most of them are out of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in San Francisco, which has the best law in the country on this. And there's quite a few cases, so you get some idea of the kinds of rights that you have that are being abused by the juvenile system. The first right is this warrantless removal of children. The second thing is not allowing parents to have access to their children when they're having medical care. Children who are abused in foster care. They've done studies that have shown that children are more at risk in foster care than the homes they're removed from.
Yeah. I've heard that. Yep. And it's true. That's what I've heard. But I have met the parents that are taking care of Isaiah, and that was a good thing. I do believe that they're very genuine and very good. So it's some consolation, but...
Are you trying to get Isaiah back?
Well, you know, I am trying, and I'm also under the impression that my lawyers have said that, you know, it would take a couple years to get him back from this point, still a couple more years to get him back. And it's hard for me to think that at 3 years old, he's going to go from this place where he's familiar and then come to me. And so I have to really weigh my options and really think what's best for him. I think to change, you know, places or change parents at 3 years old could really devastate a child. And so I don't know. I'm going back and forth in my head about what to do. This is like the most painful thing I've ever had to.
Well, usually, yeah, you're right. I mean, that is a huge issue. There's this thing known to psychology called reactive attachment disorder.
Uh-huh.
Describes what you're talking about.
Yeah.
That kind of a sudden break in a family relationship.
Yeah.
It can create permanent problems for a child later down the road.
Yeah.
Lack of trust.
Yeah.
And it creates problems in adult relationships, failed marriages, drug use,
yeah.
There's a whole litany of things that come out of it. And there's not really any cure, you know, so-called cure for it.
Yeah.
It's a really huge mountain for a person in that position to climb, to have, you know, a relatively happy life.
Yeah.
So my hat is off to you for thinking along those lines, thinking about your child, you know, and what that would be like if at the age of three that child comes back to you when you've had custody, you know, in his whole life.
I have to put him first.
4 hours.
As hard as it is, I have to put him first. And I know that if I got him back at three, it would not, it probably wouldn't be good for his mental health, and so I think that I'm leaning towards
especially because he's in a good home apparently. And I guess the one thing for you is that there'll come a time. Is it a boy or a girl?
It's a boy.
Okay, there'll come a time in his life when he's going to be very curious about you. Well, you visit with him, so he knows you. Okay, I'm just saying that later on, maintain that relationship as much as you can. And things will happen that will bring him back to you. And
you can
have a really good relationship with him. But I think what you're talking about makes a lot of sense. I guess the thing that surprises me about your case is that usually with a very young child like this, they're usually adopted out within a year.
Yeah.
You've been fighting that, though, right?
Yeah, I have been fighting it, yeah.
But, you know, David, it sounds like you know, all your cases are based on people who don't want to accept the seizure of their children. So are you suggesting that your advice to every one of these people is give it up, you know, let the kid adjust to their new home and, you know, hope that things will get better later? I mean, is that what you're saying?
Oh, no. I mean, first of all, Elizabeth has a relatively unique situation because this is a child who was taken at birth. Now, most children are not taken at birth. They are taken, you know, much older than that. So they already have formed an attachment to their parents. And it's a different landscape. But every case is unique, and you have to analyze it uniquely. So, you know, for example, that first case I mentioned where the woman was seriously public, her children were 9 years old when they were taken.
Wow.
Mm.
You know, I have other kids that are 12, 13. So it all depends on these formative years between 0 and 3 or 4.
Yeah.
Where this issue that we're talking about becomes really, really important. And I think Elizabeth is analyzing it in a way that
shows her concern for her child exceeds the concern of these other people, that's for sure.
As an attorney, have you ever taken a case of someone whose child was taken at the age of, somewhere under the age of two?
Yes, well, I had one case where a child, they put a hospital hold on a child, and then they just released the child a couple of days later. We filed suit on that.
Oh.
So you got in there in time. So
I was
very quick. We're a year late calling you up.
Yeah.
Sorry about that.
I'm trying to think, Robert, what other cases I've had where children were that young. I think there must have been some, you know.
Did you give the same advice to them that you sounds like you're giving to Elizabeth?
I'm not giving advice in the legal sense. I'm just
no, this is emotional.
About.
This is more emotional. But.
I don't know. I don't really remember that too much.
Okay. I mean, this is a new issue to me, and I'm kind of treating it in an abstract way, so I hope I'm not stepping on too many toes here, though usually I don't really give a shit, but I should, because, you know, but it seems to me, you know, I don't know the answer to these questions. I just, you know, when I hear that people's children are being taken away illegitimately and unnaturally, it sounds like, and also for profit, this is what Elizabeth is saying, what you seem to be suggesting can also be a motivation, I get cranky about the whole thing.
Well, it's something that people should be cranky about.
I'm
cranky about it all the time.
Yeah, I mean, I've been devastated by this, and I don't know what to do. I mean, I guess I can, you know, raise awareness, but I'm not sure what to do with all of this rage and all of this pain, and I have to go forward in a mature way. I mean, I have my music, you know, and that's one way, but it's just, it's unbelievable what they can legally do.
We have a caller. Maybe this would be a question for one or the other or both of you. Hi, you're on Free Radio with David, Elizabeth, and Robert. Hey there. Can you hear me?
Oh, yes. I was just listening to your show here and your guest, and this is such a really important issue. And
you have children yourself, caller? Yeah.
Yes.
Has this happened to you or someone you know?
No, but I was watching a documentary once on a homeless person's child who was taken from her, and it was a very emotional thing to watch.
Mm-hmm.
And but I think that your guest, I don't know, deserves some kind of recognition or compensation or
justice would be nice, and reuniting her with her child would be nice too. Even if you could be reunited tomorrow, I guess you'd say yes.
Of
right?
course, yeah, of course. Yeah. There, yeah.
Any questions for for either my guest or David Beauvais, the lawyer, and who's been working in this field?
Yes, it seems that and this is one one issue that really can be solved in the courts, right? I mean, it's really focused on and can be remedied. You know, it's kind of like a state, a bureaucratic issue. You know, that's established. You know that you know these kind of situations are going to develop. You know,
you mean in terms of CPS acting inappropriately and the courts somehow being able to correct that situation? Is that what you're suggesting?
Yes, and then the victim being recognized as a victim of something that happened, and then, I'll move on from there.
Let me ask David about that. David, is there any country or state where this is better addressed than California or Oregon?
Not that I know of. It seems like all of the states are pretty much the same on this stuff. I haven't heard of any state that has, some way of doing this that is, better than the way it's done here. Some counties are better than others.
in California, it's not the same everywhere. For example, Santa Clara County is really careful about the warrant requirements.
Because of the publicity of the San Jose Mercury News?
No, I think it's because of lawsuits.
Lawsuits that they
woke up.
Uh-huh.
I think Alameda County has finally woken up, but I'm not 100% sure of that. But many of the other counties act like this whole body of federal law that requires them to comply with the Fourth Amendment doesn't exist.
Fourth Amendment is the right to be free from unlawful searches and seizures, right?
Correct.
Any other questions, caller?
No questions. Just a comment. It's a very, a very important issue. You know, I mean, we're like, more of a, curbing the arbitrary use of power against people.
Hear, hear. Right? Yeah, I agree with you there.
Yeah.
So, but I mean, we have to recognize that, how are we going to compensate the victims and move on and, mm-hmm.
How do we stop it from happening in the first place? Sounds like CPS needs to be reformed or eliminated or replaced or something. That's often been the concern.
Yeah.
I appreciate your call, caller. Thanks for calling in.
Thanks for calling.
All right, thank you. Bye.
What about that, David? And I should ask you also, Elizabeth, are there alternate institutions in other countries than CPS that do a better job of dealing with potential child abuse and problems that juveniles have that aren't addressed by parents?
Well, a lot of the third world countries have no structures at all dealing with it. The Western European countries have structures. Not too familiar with them, except I know that in England there are the same kinds of abuses that go on in England that go on here.
Huh.
How about the Scandinavian countries? Know anything about that?
I don't know about Scandinavian countries.
I expect full research the next time we talk there, Bove.
I never even thought about it until you mentioned it.
Well, there you are.
Now start researching those countries.
Yeah, maybe you'll find some. They're doing some good stuff over there. Who knows?
You know, he was asking.
They're generally more enlightened than we are anyway.
Yeah, they are. Very much.
The caller
was asking about, can this be righted in the justice system? Can we make this wrong right? You know, I've read there's a whole host of crooked judges along with this whole thing, and crooked therapists who evaluate people and say they're crazy, and there is a whole. So yeah, can it? I don't know if it can all be. CPS has to be reformed, like you said, or eliminated.
Yeah, you've touched on a really important issue. The whole structure is built in such a way that, for example, if therapy is needed.
Right.
The parent is ordered to go to the department selected therapist.
Uh-huh.
Or maybe the parent is given some kind of illusory choice. They get a list of therapists.
Uh-huh.
They're all people that work with CPS.
Uh-huh.
And they get paid by CPS. And they answer to CPS.
Yes, they do. Mm-hmm.
And if they don't come with the recommendation that CPS likes, they're just quietly dropped from the list.
Yeah. Yeah, that's
or
right.
They'll fire them from the case and bring in another therapist who will say the things they want to have said.
Exactly.
That's another reform that would be useful is to that all of the ancillary services that are provided, the drug program, the batterers program, all of these people should not be getting money from CPS.
Exactly.
And what happened to you, Elizabeth? You said that you're...
Well, I was evaluated by this therapist who, oh my gosh, it was hilarious to me. I mean, not really funny, but just looking at his comments, because, I'm a performance artist, and I'm very... personable, I like people, and one of the comments he made about me was socially awkward. Like, all these things were so, they're contrived things that he says about people, and all these, that was one of the things I remember, and I just remember thinking, how funny that he would say that, because I'm very sociable, and...
You think it was sort of a script he was
Yeah, it was a script that he writes and says that this person isn't able...
you know, dehumanizes them by saying things.
Name of the therapist?
Dr. Eric Morrell.
And did you get complaints about him from other people? Did you talk about other women who had lost, other parents who had lost their kids via this therapist?
I talked to a couple other people who were being evaluated by him and agreed that he was...
Quack, quack?
Yeah. Yeah. But anyway, so basically, he's hired by them. He gives them the answer that they want, and it is always that this person is crazy or weird.
Have you found that kind of problem in the cases you've been with, David, that the therapists seem to be a little too compliant with CPS, maybe even have a corrupt relationship?
Yes, it's almost invariably.
Uh-huh.
It's nearing 100%.
Yep.
So if I have clients who need to go to one of those people or order to, I usually try to get somebody myself and have them go to the person that we choose.
Yeah.
For an evaluation, anyway.
That's good.
We're talking with Elizabeth and David Beauvais on the issue of a corruption in CPS, what's a mother to do when her child is taken from birth from her, and what can be done to reform the system, if anything. David's a lawyer, has been working on this issue for how many years now?
My first case on this was in 2000.
So okay. And you've been practicing for over 25 years, right?
Yeah, I did juvenile dependency before that. I also sat as a pro tem judge in juvenile cases.
Uh-huh.
I've had the kind of like the experience from the bench as well.
Mm-hmm. So I want, you know, originally I asked you to call in on two subjects, David. One that you had, we'd asked you to talk about before, because you are also my defense lawyer in these felony conspiracy cases that I am and 10 others are charged with in Santa Cruz. And naturally you're going to reveal your entire strategy here to the prosecution just to kind of give them a little help. They did pretty so poorly the other day in court. Actually, though, I'm interested, I think people are interested, well, the discussion was going to be around the nature of conspiracy and how it affects political activists. Before I close this kind of topic down, is there anything either of you want to conclude or say with or add on the subject of, you know, what CPS's abuses are, the court's collusion with CPS, so forth?
Well, I think maybe the one thing that I would add to it that kind of aggravates the whole situation is that, especially in the larger counties, judges who work the juvenile bench are generally the newer judges.
Uh-huh.
Because it's not, they don't want to be there. Most judges don't want to deal with this for a couple of reasons. I mean, number one, it's not a career path to the appellate court.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't get your name in the paper much. It's kind of lonely. And it's sometimes in a different courthouse away from all the other cases. And so when you're at the bottom of the judicial ladder, you tend to end up in the juvenile court system. Also, a lot of the cases are handled by commissioners or referees, these subordinate judicial officials, because the regular judges, if they can pawn this stuff off to a commissioner or a referee, do so. So it's not... it doesn't have a lot of glamour. Now, having said that, there are also a few judges who are really dedicated to the welfare of children.
That's
and
nice.
They are happy to be there. You know, when I mentioned Judge Nash in Los Angeles, he's one of them.
Good.
And there's a few of them sprinkled around in the court system, but not too many of them.
Yeah.
So it's a backwater, and it's a place where, you know, the judges, I think, because they're not invested in being there for any considerable amount of time, aren't interested in being reformers.
Mm-hmm.
And plus they're new, so they're kind of like haven't maybe even found their judicial voice yet. And so they are more likely to go along with this system, and the commissioners are especially vulnerable because their continued employment is dependent on the judges. It's not dependent on the voters or the appointment of the governor or anything else. So they are much more vulnerable if they were to become mavericks in that system. Now, they're going to find themselves being moved over to handling the traffic cases or something. You know, the speeding tickets.
Well, we're going to be awaiting your next book on the subject, David, since you seem to...
Right.
You know, seriously, I'm not saying you're... No, you're going on about it, and I think in ways that are... You know, you raise new issues that I think that are we haven't talked about that need to be discussed. And I imagine some people have already written about it. Maybe this website you mentioned online, which again is...
FightCPS.com.
FightCPS might have some suggestions for people to check out to understand, you know, some of the things you're saying. Though it sounds like some of the stuff you're talking about, you picked up from your own experience and may not have yet been written about in any collected way.
Yeah, I don't think it has. I mean, not that I know of.
Time for you to start some writing there.
There might be like some books that have been written around a particular person's story, and maybe that has happened, but. I'm not aware of any, real critiques of the system.
Yeah, and I think this could be an opportunity if you find the time to do it. You're pretty articulate. And not only that, you could make a pretty penny off of this, David, not only because I know you do a number of clients pro bono, and you need to supplement your income, you know.
Elizabeth, I wish you the best. I hope that everything works out for you.
Thank you, David. Thank you. I really appreciate it. Thank you for calling in.
And don't hang up, because we want to ask you questions we were supposed to ask you a month and a half ago, but for some reason you forgot to call in. Can you imagine? Elizabeth's taking a bathroom break, and I could take a musical break if you want. Do you still feel able to talk? You've been going for 45 minutes, so I don't know. How are you feeling, David? Are you feeling like you're up for another, 15 or 20 minutes worth of conspiracy chat?
Sure, we could have a conspiratorial chat.
Fair enough. Let's form a conspiracy to restore justice in Santa Cruz. Wait, that's what we're doing with this legal defense situation. I guess one question that's on the minds of people who are in this lawsuit, I should say, or in this criminal case, and those who are just watching, is if all these people are found not guilty, do they have any cause potentially to sue, and who should they sue, and what should they sue for?
Well, I think each defendant is probably, you know, at least uniquely situated, or there are groups of defendants that have different, defenses. So it'd be hard to address that question in a broad way. I think you have to look at each situation individually.
I mean, if individuals are taken to court by the district attorney and the police, let's say simply because they were present in a situation, is there any conceivable basis later, and they're found not guilty of the crime of conspiracy to trespass, conspiracy to commit felony vandalism, trespass and felony vandalism, which are the charges that are being leveled against the 11 of us. I know it's a general question, but really it's sort of a political question too. Is there generally recourse for folks, or do they just have to sort of take it on the chin and say, this is America, or this is California, or this is Santa Cruz, or this is Bob Lee's district attorney's show? What's the story?
Well, I mean, if you're talking about a false arrest, you can't bring that charge against the district attorney who has filed the charges and had no other connection.
No, but you're suggesting that, yeah, that's one of the kind of the charges I know that has, well, that we've successfully done. You did that, actually, I don't think you were involved in that case. It was the case of Sergeant Lauren Baker when I was falsely arrested, actually 10 years ago, for tabling. I was accused of blocking the sidewalk, which is, of course, false. And I think it was two years later, I think with Kate Wells and the Fossbinders, attorneys from out of town, I got a $5,000 settlement from Baker and also the Santa Cruz Police Department and the individual who signed the citizen arrest form, Matisse Selman of Sushi Now. But it was part of the homeless struggle to keep public space open. He didn't want to do that. He was concerned more about his business, and they were in collusion with the police here in Santa Cruz in front of New Leaf Market. But Is there ever an occasion when the district attorney is vulnerable to a lawsuit, or is he like, you know, some officials completely immune?
Well, it depends on what the function that he's performing is. If he's performing his advocacy function, or he's performing an evaluative function whereby he decides whether he's going to file a criminal charge, that's all protected by what they call absolute immunity, which means you can't sue him for that. Even if he goes into court and lies, his whole case is a tissue of lies. It's very difficult to sue a deputy public defender, a deputy district attorney or the attorney, district attorney himself for that sort of thing.
Go ahead.
The question is going to be in this case, because there were no contemporaneous arrests, who was the arresting officer? And so that's a problem.
And for those who don't understand, what this means is that at the actual 75 River Street vacant bank building leased by Wells Fargo, which hundreds of people trooped through and which was occupied as a attempt to set up a community center, at least in the words of some of the people who occupied it, no one was actually arrested at that time and on that site. They were the police chief was outraged. He negotiated with the occupiers and they peacefully left. There was some vandalism left behind, according to police reports. And the police chief subsequently posted pictures of people on the internet and video asking folks to come forward and identify people who were in the building so that they could be charged with crimes, which then later people were charged with not so much from those identifications as from original videos taken by the police department itself at that time. But these charges came 2.5 months later when several people were handcuffed and arrested at their houses and taken from their homes or taken from their jobs and held in jail on bail. Until they could be either bailed out or until they got to court and they got OR'd. Some of us were lucky enough to hear about this and went down and said, hold it, we'll turn ourselves in. We had no idea we were committing any kind of crimes. What's going on here? And, of course, of the hundreds of people that went in and out, only a few of those were arrested, even a few of those who the police obviously knew the names of because they were familiar figures in the community. A lot of people were curious about what was going on in that building. Some people were supportive. Some people were just reporters. Some people were advocates. In that situation, if the district attorney then chooses to prosecute later, I guess it was proposed to me by one attorney who heard about this case, David, that there was some argument for trying to disqualify or recuse the district attorney. And I'm not saying that this is necessarily a good strategy, but since the district attorney seems to be, as you say, immune, if he can lie all he wants, he can engage in witch hunts and false charges, and there's no responsibility there other than perhaps the voters can vote him out the next time, which doesn't come up for two more years. Is there any kind of at least slap on the wrist if he gets, can he be recused? What kind of evidence is necessary to remove him from the case?
Well, that's very difficult. And that's the discussion that we were just having about absolute immunity doesn't apply to that. The absolute immunity applies to action against the district attorney for damages.
Right, but removing him from the case is not damages, it's something else, right?
On recusal, first of all, it's very difficult to get anybody recused. And the kind of situation you need, in this particular case, recusal doesn't jump out at me and say, yeah, this is the way to go.
No, I understand, but I'm looking for...
You have to articulate something that represents a bias that is collateral to the prosecution of the defendant himself. I'll give you an example. If a secretary working at the district attorney's office is a victim of a crime and the district attorney is prosecuting that crime, the district attorney may be subject to recusal because the district attorney has a separate duty to do justice other than just represent what they call the people of the state.
has an independent obligation to do justice, and the argument would be that because that secretary is in his office, the person he knows really well and he has a relationship with, even a power kind of relationship with, that the defendant, the public would not feel confident that the district attorney would do justice in that case.
So it's the appearance of impropriety?
It is both the appearance or the actuality of impropriety.
Mm-hmm.
But appearance is enough.
Now, the reason I raise this issue is I originally kind of asked you to speak on the issue of conspiracy more broadly and how it becomes a political tool in the hands of some politicians and district attorneys historically, and I think particularly in this case here as well. So I think, I want to move into that area too, to talk about that and the nature of a conspiracy charge, which usually an ordinary person hearing the word conspiracy would think that's sort of people in the secret room say, we're going to go out and shoot this guy, or we're going to go out and plant and rob this bank, and then they go out and they do it. And so they're not only robbing the bank, but I suppose there's a conspiracy to rob the bank, which is important if, let's say, there's a person who's a part of this conspiracy who doesn't actually show up at the bank, but they want to charge him with something. They arrest everybody at the bank, and there's a third person who is part of that conspiracy. He was in the room. Maybe he was the driver guy who got away, whatever. That's what I think most people think about as a conspiracy. So they think, well, in order to be convicted of a conspiracy, you have to plot with somebody, and you have to engage in some criminal behavior. Yet, we have two individuals who, reporters, Alex DeRosi and Bradley Stewart, who were taken before a judge for a preliminary hearing last month, and the only, quote, evidence against them was not that they had conspired to do anything, but that they were present reporting and at points were inside the building. There was no evidence that they trespassed in the sense that, the technical sense, that they were asked to leave and refused to leave. But simply that they were there, and the judge felt that that was enough evidence to... he dropped the felony vandalism conspiracy, which I think we could talk about too, because people can be convicted of vandalism and conspiracy to vandalize even if they touched nothing, because somebody else did it and they're part of this group, therefore they're responsible for what other people who they may not even know about or may have done it at another time, unconnected with them, did it. And therefore, I mean, I'm trying to kind of get across that what seems to be happening here, as I understand it, is not conspiracy in the sense that ordinary people understand it, but a legal sense of the law which makes people very vulnerable to significant prison terms. It's up to 3 years in jail for this crime. Do you know the penalty for this particular conspiracy to commit felony vandalism and the conspiracy to trespass, which is the crimes that are charged against all the we're charged against all 11 of us and are still charged against 7 of us?
Yes, 3 years, right.
That's what I thought it was. And the trespass is 6 months. So each of us faces a total of 2 trespass charges and 2 felony conspiracy charges, which amount to, actually, there's a felony conspiracy and then there's a felony vandalism charge, which I assume amount to a total of 7 years total if you add all those charges together. Those are pretty serious charges. But they essentially involve...
Well, I don't want to go into California sentencing calculations, but it doesn't actually pencil out to 7 years.
But somewhere around there? Or?
A lot of time. I mean, it's more than seems to serve justice in this kind of case, and I doubt that any of the defendants would actually go to state prison on this case. It really is a state prison case.
Hmm. But there would still be jail terms and the threat of that hanging over their heads, right?
Right, there would be, and it's no small matter to have a felony on your record. Although, in this particular instance, at least the conspiracy to commit trespass could be reduced to a misdemeanor at some point along the road, because there is a misdemeanor conspiracy possibility here with these charges.
But again, you know, we're talking, this is sort of the legal thicket, the tangle of the law. For ordinary people, the whole purpose of laws is to protect the community from real crimes. So you have a crime of murder, you have a crime of theft, you have a crime of conspiracy, where that... But here, in this case, conspiracy doesn't seem to mean what ordinary people thinks it means. Can you clarify that for us? Am I accurately describing a distinction here?
Well, conspiracy is kind of elusive, and that's one of the problems with conspiracy law is that it's not limited in any way in California. For example, in Britain, their conspiracy law is very limited. It involves crimes of public morality, and I think there's one, financial crime can be subject to conspiracy law. In the United States, you can take conspiracy and hook it up with just about anything. But this is one of the most crazy conspiracy theories that I've ever seen presented in a court.
Well, let me be devil's advocate here. Why do you think it's crazy when a bunch of people are, you know, apparently went into a building without the permission of the owner, supposedly? They stayed there for 3 days, supposedly, without... even though police asked them to leave, and then when they left, there was property damage behind. Aren't they guilty of a conspiracy to come into the building, and shouldn't they be punished and brought to justice? And isn't that conspiracy law a good way to do that?
No, I think trespass law would work just as well, and I also think that vandalism statute would apply. You don't need to have a conspiracy. I mean, conspiracy is often used to bring people into the net who were not direct participants in the activity itself. And it's also a way of attributing the conduct of one person to another, even though that other person didn't do that specific act. So that's the way, I mean, conspiracy law works in general. But you still have to have a meeting of the mind to commit the unlawful act, and you have to have an overt act in furtherance of that, although that overt act could be something less than an attempt to commit the crime. And upon the unlawful agreement coupled with a single overt act, which can be totally innocuous, you've got a completed crime right there, even if nobody ever stepped into the bank.
But I'm trying to cut through the legal language, which is a little hard for me to...
Okay. What I'm trying to say is that just because people are involved in an activity doesn't mean that there is a conspiracy among those people.
So a political protest, which I think everyone, prosecution and defense, both acknowledges this was a large protest walking to various banks to raise community awareness that we have a number of criminal banks in this country and in this community who are engaging in huge regular crimes and ripoffs and being rewarded by the government for what they do. Wells Fargo was, I think, the ultimate focus in this particular protest.
Well, it's just like everything else in this society. The bigger the heist, the more immunity you have to prosecution. Every once in a while, they'll, you know, nail somebody's hide to the wall like they did with Madoff, you know, and say, oh, look, our system operates evenly. Even the big players, the ones who do really evil stuff and steal people's money, you know, we sometimes go after them, but it has nowhere the consistency that going after welfare fraud has, for instance.
Sure, and there's a lot of.
You've got to get that mother, you know, who's making that extra $200 a month.
Yeah, you got to be. Yeah, right, yeah.
It's the same with this. It's like the 99%, there's a different system of justice for the 99 than there is for the 1. And you're seeing that in operation in this case. That's exactly what this case is.
And it's not just that...
Fargo is engaged in the most outrageous conduct, and there aren't even civil charges, much less criminal charges, against them being brought by the government.
No, I think Wells Fargo recently had a settlement which Kamala Harris, the Attorney General of California, resisted for a while. But essentially, it allows the large banks that stole people's homes for hundreds of thousands of dollars in these foreclosure frauds and these phony derivative bundles and so forth in this bubble that happened 4 years ago are required to pay, what, $2,000 per victim now, some such thing?
Yeah. Well, who's gone to jail? What Wells Fargo executive has gone to jail?
No, instead you...
Bank of America has gone to jail.
Exactly.
Where's the death penalty for corporations that do this kind of stuff?
Indeed, and I think that's been the purpose and is a continuing purpose. Even a protest had happened against Wells Fargo and Bank of America yesterday and the day before in San Francisco, where people, they occupied... I guess they went into a Wells Fargo shareholders meeting day before yesterday.
Right, they own shares too, some of them.
And they own shares, and
they brought their shares with them and couldn't get into the meeting.
Right, but you know their number of them were arrested for trespass. I imagine. I'm not sure it was for trespass, but if they were arrested for trespass under the theory that DA Bob Lee and Rebecca Young have down here, she's the prosecutor who's directly involved in this case. They would also be, would they not be? Could be charged for conspiracy to engage in trespass?
I don't know, because I don't know exactly how all that came down. I do know it was planned. I'm not sure the break-in at 75 River Street, if you want to call it that, was planned.
And there isn't, the word break-in is probably not accurate, because there's no indication anything was broken into. There was apparently, according to...
Well, I read somewhere, and I don't know the truth of this, but there was a lockbox and a key in it.
There was a lockbox with a key that somehow people got, as I understand it from the police reports, and the place was opened up. Now, once it was open and there were police standing by and people were streaming in and out and police were watching placidly, is that a break-in? I would find it an unusual usage, I suppose. Maybe the police were deeply intimidated with their guns and tear gas and batons and the force of law behind them. But it's hard for me to see that, and that's what really amazes me. Bob Lee put these videos online that shows people coming and going, police officers sort of standing by watching, chatting with some of the demonstrators and so forth. It's just it's a surreal scene.
Yeah, it is, actually. It's very unusual. And I know that they're going to say that the crowd was too big. They didn't have the manpower to actually shut it down right then and there. But it also seems clear that they were not particularly vigilant in warning people not to go in, or I don't know if they ever went in themselves and told people to leave.
Yeah, I don't know if there's any indication. There's some indication that Sergeant Harms went to the door, according to the police testimony, at some point, and made a relatively quiet announcement that at least other testimony said that few people could hear. So there may have been some warning given to some people. But again, getting back to this conspiracy issue, is this something that's been used in other political cases you've been involved with that has been done essentially to heighten the up the ante, so to speak, and encourage people to take what they invariably do? We were talking earlier about CPS cases. I think it's generally true in criminal cases that 95% of criminal cases are plea bargained out.
Or they terminate before trial. A lot of times there are dismissals.
And there are dismissals. We had this amazing dismissal yesterday, which I thought was due to a lot of incompetence by District Attorney Rebecca Young in this situation, where four defendants were told that, you know, they supposedly got all these conspiracy to trespass, conspiracy to create felonies, but there was no evidence that they trespassed in the first place. There was no evidence that they vandalized. So the judge kind of threw up his hands and said, you know, I'd really like to help you. He didn't say it in those words, but that seemed to be his attitude to Rebecca Young. But, what can we do? These elements of the crime are not going to be provable, and therefore we can't really forward this case to trial. Of course, at which point Rebecca Young immediately then said, okay, we're going to refile anyway. Now, let me ask you about that. If at a preliminary hearing charges are thrown out and the cases are refiled, they can go straight to trial anyway, right?
Well, there's two ways the DA can go with that. The DA can refile and get a new preliminary hearing. And the you know, and then the case would proceed that way, or the DA could file an information, which is the charging document that follows a preliminary hearing. And if that happens, then the defense would bring what's called a 995 motion challenging the information and asking that it be set aside. And to the extent that the magistrate who heard the case at the preliminary hearing decided credibility issues, those credibility determinations the people are going to be stuck with. The district attorney will be stuck with those. And so it's going to come down to questions of law, whether there was enough evidence to constitute a crime.
So let's look at this, because both these things are happening in this set of cases. In the one situation with Alex DeRosi and Bradley Stewart, the two journalists who were given a preliminary hearing in March, and who they had the felony vandalism and the conspiracy to commit felony vandalism charge dismissed by Judge Silman, who heard that case. But the other conspiracy charge, conspiracy to trespass, and the two trespass charges were not. They're going to be going directly to trial on May 20th. Although they have, I understand, I'm told by one of their attorney's assistants filed what you say is a 995 motion to dismiss those charges. So in this case, the district attorney, Rebecca Young, went forward and tried to proceed by information to take the case pretty much directly to trial. What would the charges go to trial? Would there be any hearing short of the trial where that would be stopped by Judge Silman or some other judge? It wouldn't be tried by Silman. I think it's going to be tried by Judge Burdick.
Yeah, it'll be a different judge. I mean, if the 995 is granted, then the case gets set.
But now, so there's a hearing that's coming up for these two individuals in this 995 motion, or it's done in camera behind closed doors?
No, it's open court.
So that actually is probably the next event coming up. For those who are following this case, there will be, I presume, a 995 hearing to determine whether at least the charge, is it all charges or just the charges that were dismissed and then refiled by the district attorney?
Well, the 995 would attack, well, it could attack any of the charges that were before the magistrate judge. I'm going to call it. It's a little confusing now because we used to have municipal courts and preliminary hearings were municipal courts. Now it's a unitary court system. So I'm going to call the judge who heard the preliminary hearing the magistrate because they still use that term, even though he's a regular judge just like all the others.
Mm-hmm.
The 995 could challenge all of the charges or it could just challenge the charges that were filed after the magistrate decided to dismiss those charges.
And there will be a hearing before another judge who to determine whether that 995 motion, which will either challenge the charges that were dismissed and then refiled, or all the charges should be dismissed.
Right.
And what kind of arguments and evidence are involved in that hearing?
Well, it basically comes down to whether or not there was sufficient evidence at the preliminary, and there's different ways in which you can challenge and information. But what seems relevant here is lack of sufficient evidence to justify the charges. So it becomes a question whether or not the prosecution sustained their burdens of proof, probable cause, as to the charges that were found.
And the only evidence that they can use is evidence that was presented at the preliminary hearing, or can the prosecution bring in new evidence?
No, it's limited to the preliminary hearing.
So what Rebecca Young apparently has told us she's going to do in the case of the four people who were discharged yesterday of all charges by Judge Burdick, declared to be free and innocent, and or at least the charges are gone. I guess they're innocent, I mean, at the moment. What Rebecca Young is saying is she is going to refile against two of them, and maybe against all four of them, the same charges, and she will then seek a new preliminary hearing where she can bring up new information to support the charges. That's the other road that can be followed, right?
Yeah, there's two roads, and one of them is to just refile the complaint.
Now, is this a costly approach for the district attorney? I mean, what, is this something? I mean, it certainly costs the defense and defense lawyers, and as I think a lot of time and wear on defendants, and defendants are losing their jobs, and some of them are facing health problems. Some of them are being evicted. One of them has, you know, had a serious mental. The person has attempted suicide. We've had all kinds of consequences that have happened to this. But what about the cost to the community in terms of just simple financial costs? Is this hours spent? Do you have any sense of how much this costs for 11? If you have 11 defendants,
it's got to be enormous. I mean. Devoting all these resources to this, it's a political question of whether there's any benefit to the community in using taxpayer dollars for this. And that's a political question.
I mean, what you have, I mean, for the community, anybody listening, I'm talking to the converted here, but you have a bank that has been vacant now for 4 years. Previously it was the Coast Commercial Bank, then it was leased by Wells Fargo, but never used, perhaps because they own the bank across the street and they don't want competition, or who knows what. But it's now surrounded by a barbed wire fence, and it has not been... who knows? There may be people sleeping in the bank now, for all we know. There are actually two or three banks, at least, that are vacant now in Santa Cruz as the economy continues to deteriorate. And people outside are homeless, have no place to go, and people find vacant buildings to sleep in. I guess the difference in this occupation was people were quite upfront about it, wanted to negotiate with Wells Fargo, according to stories I've been... that I've read in the Good Times and police reports about what was said by the activists. I'm being careful in what I'm saying, and I apologize to listeners for this, because on my attorney's advice, I should try to avoid incriminating statements. Is that true, David Beauvais?
Well, I would go beyond that. You probably should avoid any statements, whether they're incriminating or not.
And that
has to do with your role in any of this.
Right. I mean, so... If I've said in the past I walked into the building, that would be the kind of statement the district attorney would eat for lunch.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's obviously not in your interest.
Even though, but my problem, of course, is I have a countervailing interest, which is to put out truth to the community, which is always a difficult matter, I guess, for attorneys who are dealing with political activists and trying to defend them. You've had this problem before, probably with other clients. You've been defending People's Park advocates 2 decades ago, and...
Well, they are a little different, you know. I mean, the standard advice you're going to get from a lawyer is keep your mouth shut.
Right.
And but it's up to the client to choose to follow that or not follow it, because they have to live their own life and deal with the consequences of it.
And another issue for defendants in this case has been attorneys urging them not to meet with each other for fear this will be used as proof of conspiracy. Kind of after-the-fact conspiracy. So every single client has been told by their lawyer, I don't think you told me this, but then you weren't my lawyer initially, and I don't know if my previous lawyer, Nicole Lambros, told me this or not. I think she might have. Don't meet with other people who are part of this. Don't be a part of a defendant support meeting. Stay away from other defendants and so forth. Don't talk about your case to anyone.
I agree with that as you posed it. It's probably not wise for the defendants to huddle together. I wouldn't say that their doing so was in furtherance of any kind of conspiracy. The conspiracy relates to the occupation of the bank, and that's over. So this is all after the fact. It's not within the facts of the so-called crimes themselves.
So the reason that you would advise them to not to get together with each other wouldn't be because they can be charged with either new crimes, or because this could be used as evidence to further the claim that they're part of a general conspiracy around the bank.
So the reason that you don't want to do this is because there is no legal privilege among the defendants.
No confidentiality, you mean?
Right. Now, if they are in a group meeting with a lawyer or lawyers, that's different, because that would be protected.
And yet...
But also, you got to make sure that that group is composed of only the client and the lawyers, not other people, except perhaps investigators or people, ancillary staff of the lawyers could be there. You could have interpreters there, you know, that sort of thing. But,
and of course, the problem is that this works directly against any kind of meaningful meeting and organizational work by defendants if they want to meet together, because, first of all, they can't persuade public defenders to take any time out even to talk to them between hearings, much less to talk to them in you know, solidarity political meetings that would help people to help raise community awareness of the abusiveness of these charges and urge the DA to drop them. So they can't really get lawyers into these meetings. And if they could get one lawyer in, there would be the problem that other clients are not supposed to talk to the lawyers of other clients, right?
Without the permission of the lawyer.
Right. And the lawyer has said, don't talk to anybody. They're not going to get the permission of the lawyer. And this brings me to another issue, which is important,
but
I think.
Then you've got to be careful about what the agenda is.
And what's...
Well,
whose agenda? What are you talking about?
The agenda of the meeting. Of these, let's say that all of the attendants got together and had a meeting.
Right, which we have.
What is said at that meeting, you know, could possibly be inquired into by the DA, but probably only in a situation in which one or more of those defendants took the witness stand.
Say that again. One or more of the defendants did what?
Witness stand.
Took the witness stand.
Right. Yeah. In other words, if you're in that meeting and you take the stand, the DA can ask you about that meeting. Who was there? What was said?
Right. And if you say something like, we talked about a common defense because of the abusiveness of these charges, that somehow could nonetheless be used by a clever DA to reflect badly on the defendants?
Well, possibly. I mean, because it raises this kind of inference of collusion, and it sounds ugly. But I was thinking more along the lines of defendant A takes the witness stand, and the DA says, what did defendant B say at the meeting about what he did when he was in at 75 River Street? What did defendant C say about it, you know? Didn't defendant B say X, you know? And there could be a whole line of questions exploring the subject matter of that meeting. And that's why it's not a good idea.
At least it's not a good idea to talk about what specifically happened on the days in question.
Yeah.
Not because what happened in the days in question is a real crime, but because it is being considered to be a crime by the district attorney and being used to criminalize, I think this is the whole point, to criminalize the Occupy Santa Cruz movement and to criminalize activists generally and to chill them from supporting each other and even considering the kinds of peaceful protests that in the past have included occupations. I think you and I got together. Our first legal get-together was an occupation of a thing called the Heiner House in 1992. Do you remember that?
Yes.
And, you know, you, as your attorney, you might advise me not to talk about that, right? Because it would alert the district attorney to claim that I have a criminal history of occupation. Might that be true?
I don't know. I'd rather not get into that discussion right now.
Right. And I mean, I think you're proving my point, right?
Right.
So this is a dutiful...
I just want to say one thing that, you know, you had mentioned, like, is this unprecedented where they would do this? And I guess the closest thing I can remember to it in history would be the Chicago conspiracy trial.
Of 1968.
Right.
Actually, 69. 68 was the Chicago conspiracy police riot at the Democratic Convention there, in which they were beating people up. And then they charged eight people, the Chicago Eight, one of whom was gagged and separated, Bobby Seale, and they had instead the Chicago Seven, which is kind of the more famous white guy trial.
Right. That's what I was talking about.
Right. That's a...
That's where Abby, I think it was Abby Hoffman...
Jerry Rubin. Yeah.
We couldn't even agree on lunch. So, you know, I mean, I don't know what facts the DA thinks she has to show that there was any kind of planning of this. Now, it's possible to prove conspiracy by the conduct of the defendants, even if you can't prove that they got together at such and such a place and penciled out how they were going to make this happen.
Which seems to be, and this is the point I brought up originally when I started talking to you about this, this is the difference between a common understanding of what conspiracy means and the actual kind of punitive use of this charge in our case. Because I've been to two preliminary hearings now. I've seen the evidence that the district attorney has provided to, at least to us so far, and it is essentially, there is no evidence whatsoever of any collusion between any of the defendants of any kind, even either at the meeting, at the building in question, the vacant bank, before the vacant bank, or immediately after the vacant bank. So it has to be simply, you're saying, some kind of, they were all there, and that indicates somehow a conspiracy.
That would be with the DA's argument, but I don't think it's a very good argument.
Neither did Judge Burdick, by the way. Yes,
and I think what you have to show, if you're going to try to show a conspiracy by conduct, you're going to have to show that there was a design that was carried out. Now, you're going to have to show, for example, let's say it's a bank robbery. You know, if people go in there like they know what they're doing because they planned it and they position themselves in certain strategic ways, or one person was going around smashing the surveillance cameras, another one was by the door, and a third one was hopping over the counter to get to the money trays, and a fourth one was with a gun going into the vault, and they all just acted out that kind of a scenario.
What about somebody in a bathroom?
Let me finish.
Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
That would imply planning, because
right.
You don't go in there and get that result without planning.
Right.
It's intelligent design of a bank robbery.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's not what happened here. Just because a bunch of people went through a door is not the kind of distinctive act which shows that they got together and decided to do this.
Hmm. How about somebody in a bathrobe with a tape recorder interviewing people?
Well, that person is suspect right from the gate.
Of course, of course. Yeah, obviously some kind of... we might want to call CPS and have him take... Except he's probably a little too old for that.
At least take the teddy bear into custody.
That's been done. The teddy bear was banned from the courtroom on at least two occasions. So. That's Eduardo, the police bear, who had to wait outside. Actually, I'm what I'm referring to, for those who don't know, is I appeared in two courtrooms with a bathrobe and teddy bear for arraignments and actually for other court appearances in solidarity with people who have to face the sleeping ban laws in Santa Cruz. And indeed, the occupation of this building, I was told, in part had to do with the fact that there's a large homeless population in Santa Cruz who have no place to go for the winter. 95% of the people are outside with no legal shelter. You have twice as a significantly greater death rate than for ordinary people, and the assault rate is four times as much, and the people die 20 years younger. So there's been a big issue about homeless vulnerability, and that's why. And the response of the city is to talk nice about it, and then to criminalize people for necessary behavior in public spaces like sleeping. So, hence my bathrobe and teddy bear, and the bailiff didn't like my teddy bear and insisted that the bear remain outside. And, of course, he did. So, we're talking with David Beauvais, attorney at law, who has generally been a pro bono representer of a lot of people, though you are actually a professional attorney who make your livelihood by representing people, right, in cases.
In a variety of cases, yeah.
In a variety, but you've also done a lot of work where hundreds of hours, maybe more than that, representing people who haven't paid you a dime.
I've done some pro bono. I think all lawyers should do pro bono.
Uh-huh. I know that you've had some bad experiences with the Santa Cruz courts here in cases where you did take on a case or two pro bono with me. One of which is the the case of the metro sign blocking crime. You may remember that particular case. So.
Sure.
Yeah. What's your? You've read over a bit of the description of Judge Burdick's dismissal of the case against four defendants. What significance does that have for the other seven in your mind? Does it have any much significance, or is it simply the other are going before another judge who actually forwarded charges from the two other defendants who are going to trial on May 20th, Alex DeRossi and Bradley Stewart?
Is that the Judge Stillman you referred to?
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah, Stillman will be hearing our preliminary hearing on May 29th. And he had previously said, I heard all this evidence, you know, I won't go for the felony vandalism stuff, but you guys are, you know, we're sending felony trespass charges forward to trial for at least those two. And then we have Judge Burdick's decision yesterday, which dismissed all charges against four defendants, saying that there is no evidence of vandalism, no evidence of trespass, or at least insufficient to prove trespass. And, you know, you can't cook up a conspiracy out of thin air, so... I'm not quoting him exactly. What's the significance of Judge Burdick's decision yesterday, if anything, in your view?
Well, I mean, it doesn't have any binding effect on another judge who hears other defendants' cases.
Uh-huh. Does it encourage you in any way?
Well, I don't know. I haven't really thought about that too much, whether it's encouraging or not.
Yeah, go ahead.
Obviously, you do have, you know, the specter of a judge having already heard a lot of the same facts. And although the preliminary hearing findings are tailored to the particular defendants involved, if he's expressed an opinion on the general subject matter, it seems like the defendant facing him in a second prelim is probably going to
get the same treatment.
Going to get the same treatment because the judge doesn't want to be inconsistent with himself.
And judges in these cases can't be disqualified unless you can show cause, right? You don't have a peremptory challenge against judge. Those of us who are in that going before Stillman don't have a preliminary challenge against him, a preemptive challenge. We have to show he's somehow biased, which is not likely to be shown, right?
Well, there is, of course, there's this provision that's called a 170.6 where you can challenge without showing any cause. You can only use that once. And it only can be used once in any case.
But it was used originally to disqualify Simons by another one of the defendants, and that used it up for all of us, didn't it?
Yeah, I think that's the law. I'm pretty sure that it is. I'd have to actually look at it, but I think.
So I'd like to apologize to listeners. I'm talking with Attorney David Beauvais of Berkeley, and I was going to make it and we have talked a bit about conspiracy law more broadly. But it has also gone back a lot to the actual case that 11 of us, now 7, and hopefully it'll stay 7, but I think it'll be at least 9, are wrapped up in, I think, essentially a matter of the vanity of the police chief and the district attorney's office here. I'm still not clear of the motivations of this case, and I'm hoping to understand more of it. Well, David, I appreciate your coming on the air. Do you have any other thoughts you want to share with us on this issue? Are you
nothing that comes to mind.
Okay. Well, then I'll just let you go.
All right. Well, you have a good evening.
You too, and thanks for taking an extra half hour. You've been going now for an hour and a half, so I appreciate your coming on the air.
Okay, I'll send you my bill.
And if you, you already have, actually. If there are any vacant banks up there that need occupying, you probably need to talk to other people at this point.
Okay.
All right.
All right, well, take care.
Yeah, you too. And it's actually an interesting issue for me because I'm always under pressure to say absolutely nothing about public issues like occupying banks and vacant buildings. But I tend to agree with what Becky Johnson put out as a sticker that a lot of us were wearing in and around the court, which is vacant buildings are the crime. They are the crime, actually. And that's really the issue here, at least one of the issues involved in this case. And
Maybe it's apprehension by authorities that their vacant buildings are all in jeopardy, although I don't see a lot of people rushing to occupy vacant buildings, and it's not something that, you know, I think that any of the defendants were really much involved in planning to do, or, you know, things simply happen in the course of events which, you know, I as a reporter, for example, report on. I certainly am sympathetic to people engaging in trying to expand public space for poor people and trying to hold banks accountable, no question about it. Did I plan such a thing? No. You know, I mean, didn't even know it was going to happen. But like many, many people, I went in to see what was going on. So, you're tuned to Free Radio 101.3 FM. Santa Cruz, California is the place I'm talking from. Coming up soon, in about 20 minutes, we're going to have Uncle Dennis doing From the Cream to the Dregs. You're going to get the cream, and if you go to the courts and check out the district attorney's office, I guess you may find some of the dregs. I suppose I'm sort of feel a little sour grapes about all this, I got to tell you. I don't like what's going on, and it bugs me. Anyway, in the last program, and I do a twice a week set of programs, on Sunday I'll be coming back with another program as well at 9:30 in the morning. I was going through interviews I did with people at the Project Homeless Connect that happened a week ago Tuesday. And I'm going to play some more of those interviews. Some of them aren't even interviews. They're attempts to interview. The next thing you're about to hear is Homeless Lack of Services Center Director Monica Martinez, who has been lying about stuff around the rights of homeless people in terms of, well, what her Homeless Lack of Services Center does if somebody comes and says, they gave me a camping ticket or a ticket for sleeping outside. Will you give me a letter that indicates that your shelter was full if it was that night? And the answer is no, they don't do that. But her public answer is yes, they do that. So it's an interesting contradiction, and I ran into her, wanted to hold her accountable for that. But she first she told me, I'd heard some sort of confusing information that she might have changed, the real policy might have changed. Unfortunately, on reviewing the interview with the person, I found that really wasn't the case, that he didn't really get the letter and he didn't get any evidence. It was, if you get on a waiting list at the Homeless Lack of Services Center, they're not supposed to give you a camping ticket. That's a new city law that somehow makes the Homeless Lack of Services Center the gatekeeper for civil rights for homeless people. If you join their racket, you get civil rights. If you don't, you don't get civil rights, which, of course, seems to me highly unconstitutional. But let's consider the positive aspect, which is, well, here's one way, you know, join with the Homeless Lack of Services Center, get on their waiting list, and supposedly they'll dismiss your tickets. Why doesn't she then give people a little statement that I'm on the waiting list so they can show that to the police? She lies about it, says she does, but nobody ever gets them. And so I wanted to approach her and ask her about that, and I did. And here's some of what happened when I did. It's not very exciting, but it's what actually went down.
Now, we spoke earlier, and you helped to clarify something that has been worrying me for a year and a half. And that has to do with, what can a person do who gets a camping ticket, who, let's say, isn't on your homeless service center waiting list?
So, Robert, I have a job to do here, and I would rather not talk into your recorder. So.
Just briefly, very quickly.
No, sorry. I'm volunteering today, and I don't want to talk into your recorder.
You may be accused of stonewalling me again. There you have it.
We have a caller. Hi there, you're on Free Radio.
Hi, Uncle Robert. You know, I happen to know for a fact that there's a a homeless person, Anonymous, was the surprise to be homeless, found himself homeless. An Anonymous Junior, who they camped together and ran together, who were suddenly, because they kept a doctor's appointment, were evicted from the loft. And but they were on the list for the shelter, and but they didn't know what to do that night, and it was pretty scary. And they slept three nights in a row at the City Hall. A parking lot, got up early before anybody noticed, and no problem. But one night, this officer came along, gave us tickets, so we went around and did what, like everybody says, to go get it removed because we're on the list and everything. But every bureaucrat points to every other bureaucrat, and it doesn't get done. And then you go to warrant, and you don't have, and it's just all over with once you go to warrant.
So let me.
It's a lie. It's not true at all. There is no safety valve. There's no safety net.
Let me understand this, David. When did you sleep, or when did these people sleep at City Hall? I'm not sure it was you or your friends, whoever it was, but. When did this illegal sleeping outside happen?
It was the end of September.
And
they just got out of the loft by surprise, because when they called to say that they had a doctor's appointment that would make them 15 minutes late, they told them not to worry about it, to come in the next night. So they came in the next night and said, oh, you didn't show up, so you're out of the program. Said, but you said for us to not show up. So it's like, you know, everybody blames everybody else for like having different rules, and there was
not only, you know, you what you're saying is that there was an exclusionary action by the Homeless Lack of Services Center's Pauley Loft program,
yeah,
that kind of predated this, that put you and your colleagues out, if it was you,
yeah,
and your colleagues. But then when you got ticketed because you slept at City Hall.
Well, we got ourselves on the waiting list first, and we kept checking, you know, those first three, four, five nights. You know, we were like trying to find out where's the best place. We'd be driven up by the edge of the Poganip, and you know, we didn't like being so much out in the country. And we were like, fun time, we were taking care of business, you know, medical or something. We were both disabled, and we found ourselves in town, and we found that right there around City Hall was real quiet, and you know, we could just duck down, and we were safe. And we felt safe, and we fell asleep, and we slept well. And I always wake up at pre-dawn, so we did that, and we got a ticket. But
how many times were you ticketed?
Once.
And so when you got tickets, you said that those tickets are supposed to, of course, be automatically dismissed. You were on the waiting list at the time, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And did you ever get a warrant, or did you ever get a failure to pay notice in the mail indicating that the ticket had not been dismissed?
I don't know that I had. They probably took my Bakersfield address off my driver's license or my senior ID. You know,
if you check with the if you check with the court in town, you can find out. And I could check too, because I think I know your name, caller.
Oh no!
I know who you are. Oh no!
The place is surrounded by sheriffs.
Yes,
now.
Your history,
everybody,
buddy.
Everybody believes in liberty.
We know you're trying
streets.
To occupy the area.
Good luck,
okay.
Uncle Robert. I'm telling you, these are pretty shaky times. As you know, we're in transition between two houses right now, and it's going to be pretty rough, but. We know we got friends like you that just paved the way and opened up new doors for us all.
Huh. I wish that were true.
I
hope
don't
it's
we
true.
All wish that were true. I try to help in my own humorous little way.
And you do. You have been helping for years, David.
Okay. Thanks, Uncle Robert. Talk to you soon.
Take care. So David Silva, former city council candidate, activist for the rights of HIV persons, and a guy who's been a homeless advocate when he was, particularly in the 90s here. Now he's been struggling a lot with personal circumstances, and you've heard him call in on the show if you're a regular listener. You're tuned to Free Radio at 101.3 FM. I'm Robert Norris. The name of the show is Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides. Been talking a lot about the 75 River Street prosecutions, which, as I said, took a turn, seemed to be a turn for the better yesterday in Judge Burdick's Department 6 court, which you can read about in a really great article by Becky Johnson on her website, or you can go directly to her website. Is Becky Johnson, One Woman Talking. blogspot.com, but if you go for Becky Johnson, One Woman Talking, you'll find her website, which she's been covering homeless civil rights issues for a couple of decades now, on that website for a couple of years, for sure. You can also go to the developing website for the Santa Cruz 11, which is santacruz11.org. I believe it's santacruz11.org. I'm never sure if it's .org or .com, but I think that's the case. Let me double-check on that, just to be sure. And her story is, she really covers the hearing at which, apparently it's a very rare finding for, I was told by a couple of people that judges don't, they sometimes throw out a few charges, but they don't throw out all the charges. In this case, verdict threw out all the charges, although, again, they can immediately be refiled, and that's apparently what's going on. So one wonders how endless this process is going to be. That's why I wasn't so optimistic about it. And I'm checking SantaCruz11.org, and we're seeing... Yeah, SantaCruz11.org has its own website, and it has some recent posts on it, as well as a petition to sign if you're supportive of dropping these charges. And I encourage everyone to do that. This is going to be a long struggle to fight back, and it's only just beginning. If any organizations you're a part of, love to have them sign on to this demand that the district attorney start spending, I mean, their time on real crimes, stabbings, murders, robberies, instead of political crimes, which is whatever displeases the city council, the board of supervisors, Susan Mariello, the chief administrative officer of the county, or police chief Vogel, or Sheriff Wowak. These should not be the consideration for whether a person is considered to be a criminal. It's whether they're committing real crimes or not. And in this case, vacant buildings are the crime, in my view. And that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. Let's hear some more from the Project Connect days. And again, we're soon going to be having a visit from Uncle Dennis. He'll be with us for 3 hours to play monotonous 60s and 70s music. Actually, it's not monotonous. It's quite quite tuneful for all. And I even enjoy it at times. But we'll see what's cooking. He also gives reports on environmental issues and stuff that I rarely listen to but probably should. And perhaps you should, too.
We're outside again, and it's about 12:25, and we have some folks who are talking with Bob Lee, the DA.
And Bob Lee is, of course, the prime DA of Santa Cruz, and he's the person who a lot of attention has been focused on because he controls whether there's going to be prosecutions in the Santa Cruz 11 case. Back in all cases, he's got the final say, as I understand it. And he was walking about. He's a tall, friendly-looking figure, and he's a friendly guy, actually. I've talked to him, personable fellow, on a number of occasions. We tried to ask him some questions, and you'll hear me asking him questions about 647E, which is a penal code that has to do with lodging, which Linda LeMaster, a longtime activist, has been on my show a number of times, is facing 6 months in jail for, which Gary Johnson, Ground Zero Gary, as I call him, has already been sentenced to 2 years for, which Ed Fry and Gary Johnson are appealing 6 month sentences for, which many Occupy Santa Cruz activists have been arrested for and cited for, which is essentially says that if you're sitting in a place that they don't want you to be, they call you lodging, a lodger, and they arrest you, and you have to deal with all kinds of court crap. And for Bob Lee to show up at a homeless event where people are getting those kinds of tickets when the police or the sheriffs don't want them to be in a certain place, but they have no legal way to remove them and no real opportunities or alternatives to offer them, to me is really an act of some chutzpah, some nerve, if you will. Let's hear this conversation. There's not, I unfortunately, because of the fact that I'm facing charges, I tend to be a little more circumspect in how I present myself in public, perhaps than I should be. I think I need to be more outspoken, but I do what I can.
Of Section 8 housing going on. And we have a shelter volunteer chatting here with the DA.
And what was the requirement of the list to keep you on it? Or?
They want you to always say where you are and you just keep informing them. If they send you something, say, yes, I still want it. And anything changed, anything married, so yes. I did it.
How did they communicate you? Did you keep a address or did you come back?
Yes, because I was homeless, my mail went to the shelter. As it wasn't for their mail, I wouldn't know.
So if somebody didn't have the, possibly have a mailing address or...
The guy is talking about the mailing address is Bob Lee.
They need to have one.
They get kind of
see there's a lot of people on Social Security. Where are your checks
going to
go?
Where are checks going to go? Right.
Pretty soon there won't be any checks.
No, need a place for that.
Electronics.
Electronic deposit. Need a place for that to happen.
Yes. So if it wasn't for the mail-in service at the time, I would not known about housing. I lost my paper. So now I'm off the street.
There's a charge, right, for this. You have 50 cents to pay for mail. Or $5 a month, I think it is now.
But see, I don't do my mail in a month. I got my own little mail-in address. But yeah, I was on that list about 7 years.
You tried the free voicemail and didn't work out for you?
Well, mine did, and I kept up on it. But what it was, I keep forgetting I was there or something like that. And certain times you called and I messed up my number, but it was working for me, too.
Uh-huh.
And then as you get a little money, you talk about a little cell phone.
Ever been ticketed for sleeping outside?
No.
Good. I'm glad to hear it.
In somewhere, I used to couch surf a lot. That's what happened to me.
Because?
So I was with grandchildren. They're 2 and 4. I mean, seven. I don't want them out there.
Yeah, I hear you. I hear you.
Kind of sleeping in people's cars with them, maybe, and the house.
But that's illegal in the city and county of Santa Cruz.
What, sleeping in cars?
Sleeping in cars is a violation,
well,
and so is...
1 year at the time.
Yeah, the DA...
We were surfing people's
Bob here has been prosecuting people who were sleeping on the courthouse steps in protest.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
But any more of those in the works, Bob, at this point, or... Bob is not answering that question. And his entourage moves off. So I'm in the food line now, right outside Conference Room C. It's around 12:30. Bob Lee is, a few moments ago, he was still standing around on the corner, glad-handing, or kind of just glad-handing. He was making himself visible in his business suit, and smiling and nodding sagely and so forth, but not answering any of the questions that I put to him. Similarly with Monica Martinez, she did not want to speak into a microphone about her policies, which made me feel that my earlier friendly interaction with her might be deceiving to me, and I might be letting myself go. We're talking to a much ticketed woman who's trying to eat spaghetti, and her mouth is probably full. What are these three tickets?
One for bedding, sitting on my bed, and two for camping. At 12:45 and then at 8:30 the same day, and then I got a ticket at 1 o'clock two nights ago.
These are all at night?
Yes, uh-huh.
And where were you, if you don't mind saying?
On the river, on one side of the river, then the other side of the river, and then I was on the river again.
How did you avail yourself of the wonderful homeless lack of services center?
I was there while it was raining, but then there was no place to be. I had to go sleep, and so I went and laid on the river where there's patrol because I feel more safe.
It's illegal to sleep in Santa Cruz. Hasn't anybody told you that?
I take 14 kinds of medicine a day, and if I have to.
How old are you?
57.
And what is your ailment?
I'm a heart patient, congestive heart failure. And
your name, of course, is?
Diane P. Gordon.
And you were part of the Peace Camp 2010 protest.
Yeah, certainly.
And is this the same police officers who have been doing this to you, or different ones?
Different ones now. It was before, it was the city police. So
did you tell them that there was no shelter?
They know. They know everything about, they know.
Just you move as well as ticketing you?
They said I had to leave soon, they put it that way, and I stayed till it got daylight. But I wrote, they told me that I would be placed in jail if I was there when they returned.
Free shelter?
No. I don't want to. I don't like jail. I can't imagine.
You've been talking with?
Yeah, Diane Patricia Gordon.
This happened when?
The last week. Three tickets. Yeah.
Tickets in the last week.
Yeah, since the armory closed, since the nighttime shelter closed, three tickets. Immediately, they ticketed everybody. 100 people went out on the street. We all started getting tickets. All of us did.
How many other people did you know got tickets?
Everybody I know got tickets.
Well, they want to be fair. Give it to everyone, you know.
Yeah.
So nobody gets left out.
Yeah, I would say probably 60 or 70 of us got tickets, yeah. A high number. A lot of people just tear them up and they don't care, but I do. I don't want to be a criminal just because I'm sleepy. All the medicines they give me, if I don't take them, I'll die. If I do take them, I can't move around. And there's no trespassing signs everywhere, no place to sit everywhere. So just no place to sleep, no place to sit, no place. So I don't know. My health is pretty important to me. Just if I could sit down and my health be better, or if I could sleep and I could live, I mean, it's a big thing.
I think you've said it all.
Thank you.
Thanks, Diane.
It's
do that.
We're talking with?
Sharon King.
And Sharon, you're off for Cabrillo in your silk screening class?
Well, yes, I'm TA for Tobin Keller's silk screening class.
And you, but you had a good time here today.
Yes, I helped a young man from Mexico who works the strawberry fields 6 months a year and hasn't had, well, he hasn't had work for 6 months because he works the strawberry fields, and he is, he's never drunk a drink in his life or smoked a cigarette, and he has four kids and a wife in Mexico and doesn't speak English. And
did you turn him into Sheriff Wowak as an illegal immigrant, perhaps?
And so we, he got some great dental care, and he is getting a voucher to go to a thrift store and get some clothes for his family, and I'm going to go get some too, and we're going to send a bunch of clothes down there, and he wants a haircut, and he'd like to talk to someone about housing, but he's smart as a whip. He's smarter than I am.
Pero tú hablas español, ¿verdad?
Sí, bastante bien para hablar con él.
You speak Spanish.
Ayudarle a mucho.
You helped him a lot. I helped you a lot.
¿Tú me ayudaste? ¿Cómo?
I'm asking, did this help you as well as help him?
Of course, of course.
You were a volunteer with one of them volunteer t-shirts on?
Yes.
And now you're in your civilian clothes.
That's right. I didn't volunteer with any organization. Anyone can volunteer. You don't have to belong to any organization to do that. You just get on the internet and you go to Homeless
Project Connect.
Homeless Project Connect, and you say, it says contact, and you contact them and you say you want to volunteer. You don't have to be a member of an organization. All you have to do is want to connect.
And get access to a computer. If you're homeless, that's a little more difficult, but not always impossible.
Isn't it true that there are computers in libraries?
It is true, but they are limited in their how you can use them. They're limited in terms of the hours of accessibility. And the library is, for my money, one of the best resources, though they attempted to arrest me once for giving flyers on the antechamber of a library.
Excuse me. What I meant was, if you wanted to volunteer and you could get access to a computer.
And what I said was that you can do that in a library, but it's a limited access. But yeah, I mean, there is a way to do that. So if you are homeless and listening to this broadcast, or housed for that matter, or whatever, you go check out Project Homeless Connect in Santa Cruz. I don't know if they're active much of the rest of the year. I think this is their one big shot, but I could be wrong.
I also would imagine that you could go to any organization that actually gives services to people in Santa Cruz County and tell them that you wanted to be involved with Project Homeless Connect, and they would give you a phone number.
Indeed. All you have to do then would panhandle 50 cents to make a phone call.
Excuse me?
Then you would just have to, if you were homeless, panhandle.
I'm not talking about homeless people. I'm talking about people who want to help as a volunteer for Project Homeless Connect.
And those
the
might
way
include.
I did.
Mm-hmm.
The way
might include homeless people. In other words, homeless might also want to be volunteers and do what you did.
I have no idea.
I think some are actually doing that today.
Uh-huh.
I've seen homeless folks who are, you know, volunteers as well.
Great. I hope that they realize that there are a lot of organizations in Santa Cruz County that can help them connect, even with Project Connect. That's what this is all about.
Well, you've been connected. Connected today. And we've been talking with?
Sharon King.
Thank you, Sharon.
Thank you.
And sounds like a naive, somewhat defensive person who has some fantasies about the extent of the services that are provided in Santa Cruz City and County for homeless people, which, as far as shelter goes, amount to a drop in the bucket. And the criminalization, the amount of energy put into criminalization far outweighs the energy put into homeless services, has been my experience. Because, after all, merchants making sure their streets are cleansed of the socially undesirable is more important than human rights or human services for people who need them. That seems to be the situation and the problem, and it's up to us to change it. So, it's 8 o'clock, and I'm expecting at any moment that Uncle Dennis is going to burst in through the doors, some of his usual regimentagem, and he'll be perhaps giving us a description of what's coming up for him. There's stuff coming up for us. I believe May 1st there's a series of protests that are going to be happening on campus and that are also going to be happening downtown. And there's going to be sort of a convergence at the post office at 5:30, as I understand it. And I'll be talking more about that when I come back on Sunday at 9:30 in the a.m. So stay with me. Might have another interview or two to run by you because Dennis seems to be a bit late today, but I'm sure he's going to come rolling in. He's, who knows, maybe he's enjoying the good weather. No more interviews at the moment, but again, I encourage people to take a look at this week's Good Times. It actually, for the first time, it actually has more political information than the week Santa Cruz Weekly, which is pretty weak, the Weekly. The one good thing about the Santa Cruz Weekly, for once last week, it actually had a cartoon by Stephen DeCinzo, who I don't have a lot of... Well, he doesn't like me much, but I find his caricatures of the city council really funny, accurate, and on target a lot. He does get dissed by some letter writer who doesn't like DeCinzo, accuses him of being inaccurate and unfactual on the desal issue. DeCinzo characterizes the city council as steamrolling over opposition to its $130 million boondoggle. But I think that's exactly what it's doing. And Don Lane's gabble-gabble about, helping to setting up its city council's own initiative for a democratic process was done only after massive pressure by opponents of DSAL. And Lane still refuses to do, which is the obvious thing, which is to put an initiative or a city charter amendment on the ballot as a city council, which would bind the future city councils. He doesn't want to do that because I think there are those in the city council that want to overturn and raise up again the DSAL issue even after the voters have voted it out. And, you know, and people will say, well, they can always vote it out again, but there's a difference between an initiative which takes 6 months, which allows you 6 months to get signatures, and that's what people who are now putting the DSAL charter amendment on the ballot are doing, and a referendum, which is an attempt, when you try to reverse a city council vote, you only get 1 month to do that. Very hard to do, rarely done. I don't know if it's ever been successfully done in opposition to city council. City council usually, on occasion, I think it's surrendered to a referendum initiative. But more frequently, when you get a, you get the referendum people surrendering, as in the De Anza rent control scam of Rotkin and Matthews back in the early days of the last decade, when they destroyed rent control for De Anza and then followed up by destroying rent control for Clearview Court. These are two of the trailer parks that actually had real rent control in Santa Cruz. And they were promised rent control in perpetuity and sold down the river by John Barisoni and his pals on the city council. Which includes pretty much the current city council, except for, well, Ed Porter is no longer on the council. And I have no love for him for most of what he's did on city council regarding homeless people. But on this issue, he took a courageous and, I think, a just stand in saying, let's keep rent control. Well, where is Uncle Dennis? He's coming to the studio late. Let's see if I can find a little something further to bring up, which I think going on to the I'm actually here. If you go to SantaCruz11.org, you will find an article by Becky Johnson, which comes directly from her really rich and well put together website. Charges thrown out against four Occupy Bank takeover protesters is one you'll find with a lot of photos. But she's got a lot of other stuff there, too, which gives you the background to not just the nonsensical prosecutions and the attempt to establish a community center and Occupy Santa Cruz's activities, but a lot of other stuff around homeless civil rights as well. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hi, Robert. I just called in to potentially be of help. It may be, and I stress may, that Uncle Dennis is scheduled to not be there this week, so you may have to load the docs or something like that.
Oh, okay. Well, that's good news. I hadn't heard that. But
you might want to check that. You know, I really hope I'm not misleading you. I mean, I'm not even in Santa Cruz. I mean, I just happen to be listening right now, and I saw you struggling with not knowing or him not being there. And I really think also knowing Dennis, he may be scheduled to not be there. Plus, you could check the email, and it might clarify the question for you.
Okay. Yeah, I have been keeping an eye on the email, and I haven't seen much. But I think it's, you know, it's a good suggestion. I'm going to put on one of his older shows. He's often asked me to do that, though. These shows are definitely older shows, and
I have a feeling, I mean, and I'm again a hunch, though I don't want to give away anything personal. At the same time, I have a feeling he may not be coming in from a recollection of an email, but like I said, it's, you know, that would have to be clarified. I mean, he might bust through the door right now, and I'm misleading you unintentionally.
Well,
though,
if he does, I'll blame you. It's very simple.
Please do, bro.
Oh, thank you.
Cheers.
All right, man. And that was our man in Fresno who's keeping an ear on us. Of course, to download one of his shows, I have to get the computer to actually respond, which is can be a challenging phenomenon. Let's see here. Is there any way to assist in this situation? Maybe if I kill this window, I can get some action here. Aha! Apparently that's the way to go. So let's see if we can actually get some action. And I want to thank all you listeners, however many you are, or however few you may be. I'll be back on Sunday at 9:30 in the morning. And if you want to catch updates on these issues, you can also go to Santa Cruz Indie Media, indiebay.org/Santa Cruz, which is a place I do a lot of writing. I did an interview with the City on a Hill Press reporter today, so maybe that'll show up next week. And a special tip of the hat to John Malka, not only for his long and inclusive story in the Good Times. I don't know if it was 2 weeks ago or 1 week ago. I think it was 2 weeks ago now. Maybe 1 week ago. I don't know. But he's done a little follow-up, too. And you'll find that in the current Good Times, where he talks straight talk about the phony charges thrown against Occupy Santa Cruz more broadly. I mean, those of us who are facing the felonies of in this River Street frame-up, which is what it really is, are suffering from it and trying to fight it, and will fight it. But there's a much broader group of people that have been repeatedly attacked and dispersed in violation of the First Amendment, the Occupy Santa Cruz movement. And they've faced multiple charges. But in order to avoid taking these charges into court, the charges generally disappear before they reach court. We'll see how far this effort by Rebecca Young and D.A. Bobley go in our case. But there is a general attack on occupies across the country. Don't let this discourage you out there, folks. This is, if you know what's right, we've got to do what you need to do in order to bring these issues forward. And I encourage people to continue to do that. You can put lipstick on a pig, but it remains a pig. And you can pretty up a bank and talk about property rights. And you can talk about how Wells Fargo gives away philanthropic stuff at different points, but the in general ripoffs that it's engaged in and its abusive bailout activity and the huge salaries and most important, the foreclosure fraud that it's engaged in are just really uncontested. It's just, unfortunately at this point, it's too big for the people to prosecute, and Bob Lee is never going to do anything of the kind. We have a caller. Hi, caller. You're on Free Radio.
Hey, Robert, I couldn't help but just call one last time. I know you want to get out of there, but I had to comment that I thought of you and Free Radio and this very issue with Wells Fargo and all, because on this, what is it? Oh, sometimes there's this actually interesting show, you know, on late at night on this right-wing talk radio station, right? So I flick it on in the morning, and these ads come on, these Wells Fargo ads, where they're focusing on this handful of Asian students that they're helping do something or other in the Fresno area. And it's much like those BP commercials. So I just wanted to say, and this could be news to some of the listeners of this station who truly may never flick on commercial radio. The banks, I think, are realizing that people are seeing what scoundrels they are, and they're really going full throttle on the PR campaigns.
Yeah, we can talk more about it in detail on Sunday when you get more details. And thanks for the tip.
Yeah, you got it. Cheers.
Bye-bye. And that's really it. Thanks for being with me on this edition.